This podcast is sponsored by Casper. Get $50 toward any mattress purchase by visiting www.casper.com/GOT and using promo code GOT. Terms and conditions apply. Welcome to the Game of Thrones podcast, the officially unofficial podcast for Game of Thrones on HBO. I'm Jim.
And I'm Aaron.
And today we're talking about Season 7, Episode 1, titled Dragonstone. This is the full recap. We did an instant take. Feels like it's 5 minutes ago.
Right.
That's kind of how this season goes. It's back to back to back here. But we're going to get a lot more in-depth on this one. So if you enjoyed the instant take, stick around. This one will probably be a lot longer, but hopefully more enjoyable.
I guarantee it'll be longer than 20-some minutes.
Yeah. What'd you think of this first episode?
This is just like your run of the mill season opener Game of Thrones. Like the only reason I guess I was a little underwhelmed is because I heard from many, many sources that like all seven episodes are going to be crazy, go nuts. And
yeah.
And I guess that's the thing is that, I guess it is kind of crazy because Arya literally murdered the entire Frey family.
That's pretty crazy.
And Dany came back to Dragonstone. I guess if I'm the double D's and I'm telling people, it's going to be all crazy go nuts, those are all crazy go nuts things.
Yeah.
But I guess our expectations were going to be, big battles and epic things.
Yeah,
like
when they
that.
Talked about the budget, right? Like, the budget's never been bigger. We have to cut it into this smaller thing because each one's going to be so expensive.
But there was like a 2-minute effect shot of ice zombies and ice giants that were awesome. And there was a lot of epic stuff with the dragons. So it's not like they didn't spend anything.
No, certainly.
And then, baseline Game of Thrones is expensive as hell because of its travelogue kind of nature. So I felt like that a lot of people were a little pleased but underwhelmed by what they saw. And the other thing is, knowing there's only seven episodes, I guess there's a sense of urgency that hasn't been in the early goings of a season in a long time. What did you think on second thought?
Yeah, I agree with you. It's pretty much, a standard Game of Thrones season opener, but all the season openers so far have been pretty good,
Right, right.
I mean, it's not like that's a real complaint. It's just, with the expectations that they set up, maybe that's on them a little bit. But, I definitely felt like slightly underwhelmed by it, even though big things are happening. And I think they're moving things along at a nice pace, right? I mean, Arya, very quickly, like, we didn't see any setup or anything. We just see all the Freys gathered, all the Freys dead.
Right.
Boom. It's over with. Dany gets there. There's no battle or anything, which, I have some problems with, but she takes Dragonstone.
Right.
It's hers. And she wants to get down to business. I feel like things are moving, so I'm satisfied in that regard.
Yeah, so I'm saying, like, I imagine if I'm in the double D's and I'm looking at the internet reaction, I'm like, Jesus Christ, we
right.
The body count and the fact that Dany's finally here and like the fact that she's not been here for six seasons is not our fault. Like we brought her here that there might be like myth that there's this like, what have you done for me lately kind of vibe. Especially since the show's been gone so long that I feel like if you're not a hardcore fan, you might be a little bit more lost than usual because it's been such a long time since we've had new Game of Thrones.
Yeah.
Which I thought the other thing I really noticed is that I thought the previously ons were particularly good.
Yeah, they helped a lot.
Like they're and not just the shot selection, but like I felt like there's a lot of production. Like
they did some editing on it.
Exactly. They it wasn't just your stock Game of Thrones intrigue music with a bunch of random disconnected scenes. Like it felt like they shot a warm up trailer for this particular episode. And I wonder if they'll keep doing that or if that was just like, okay, we've been gone for a year and a half. Mm-hmm. We really got to give people a Game of Thrones booster shot.
And they did a cold open, which they don't do a lot, right? So
Sure. Let's
get people right in this. Let's not hit them with, the HBO and then the Game of Thrones music. And let's just give it to them.
Yeah.
Overall, I'm satisfied with it. I thought it was a good episode.
Yeah.
Are we ready for the recap, or do you have more that you want to talk about?
I feel like we're ready for the recap.
Okay.
I mean, it's arguable that the instant take is essentially a very long cold open recap for the episode itself. So, right. Yeah, let's
put the instant take at the beginning from now on.
There you go. There you go.
Call it good.
Oh, I guess I do have a couple of things. Did you see the Watchers, the ratings that this show got?
No, I haven't.
Just over 17 million people wow. watched it on HBO Go or DVR'd it in the first 24 hours, which I think means that they're officially bigger than The Walking Dead now. At its height. And then if you add piracy and all that stuff, it's crazy.
Yeah.
In related news, the Game of Thrones podcast by Bald Move is the number two podcast right? in all of iTunes.
It's crazy.
Has that ever happened? I don't think we've ever cracked a top 10.
I think we have, but certainly not on episode one of a season.
Like, right.
We shot
the instant
to the top.
Take
I couldn't
of episode
believe it.
One.
Yeah, I was looking... I was looking at the top podcast thinking, okay, who do we have to beat this season, uh-huh. right? Like, there's the Malcolm Gladwell, there's the Serials yeah. that somehow perpetually stays
right,
at the top.
Right,
And I looked at it, and I was like, well, that can't be right. When I looked, it was number three. But then I saw David Chin sent us a nice message saying congrats on number two.
Yeah, I think it's only Malcolm of House Gladwell that stands in our way.
I think so. No, it's this Wondery podcast. I don't know. It's one of those like audio drama type,
right.
or audio true crime things.
Mm. We got fake crimes.
Yeah, I was excited.
We got fake crimes and fake dragons. We will beat their true crime before... yeah. Before the season's over.
And I guess you could use that as like a moment to pimp. Hey, if you like our show, leave an iTunes review.
Yeah,
we got to beat that dirty Malcolm Gladwell.
That's right.
Beat him
That's
into
right.
submission.
We got 10,000 hours of podcasting expertise. I don't think he's got it. He's got
we're
a ram couple
it right
hundred
up
at best.
His ass.
We're gonna take our mastery of it and ram it right up his bunghole.
Yep. All right.
Now I'm ready.
That sounds good.
Hey, before we go further into the episode, I want to do a little bit of housekeeping. And first, since this is the first episode of the Season 7, I know we have a lot of new people tuning in. Just brief introduction. I am one of the hosts, Aaron, and I have been a fan of the show since the beginning. I got into the books between Seasons 1 and 2. I've read all the books. I've read all the weird ones. I've read the previews for the upcoming book. I've got the World of Ice and Fire encyclopedia on my shelf to my left. I bring the in-depth book analysis and lore.
Too much lore.
Too much lore to shake even a stick at.
Yeah, I don't do the lore. I watch the show.
Who the hell
I
are
enjoy
you?
It. Jim.
There you go.
some call me by my last name, but it's not as good. But yeah, I've only seen the show. I don't truck with the books. Although I know more and more about the books since we've been doing this spoiler edition.
Yeah, I used to, on Fridays, I do the spoiler edition by myself, by my lonesome. Since the book started overtaking, or the show started overtaking the books, Jim has joined me on those Friday journeys. So he's more hep than your average show watcher cat.
Mm-hmm.
But he's here to say, what the fuck, when I get way off into the weeds.
We're getting geared up for the 6th annual Summer Badass Fest. And while we're working on a slate of Apex badass films to enjoy, we've got an early action-packed announcement to make.
Just like last year, we're kicking off Badass Season with a live movie watch and podcast recording. We've rented out a theater for connoisseurs of action films and Bald Move fans that just want to have a great time.
Unlike last year, this year's movie is top secret. Hush, hush. No hints. Except, it's incredibly badass. It stars an absolute icon of the genre. We're willing to bet most of you haven't seen it, and it's going to be an incredible viewing experience with a packed house of Bald Movers.
Those of you who came to last year's screening of Total Recall know what a party it was. And those of you who didn't, now's your chance to experience it. Meet me and Jim. Order some custom movie-themed drinks at the theater's full bar. Then watch us record the full podcast for the movie. We reserved a venue over twice the size as last year, but seating is still limited.
It's happening Friday, June 21st at 7 p.m. in our hometown of Cincinnati. Get full details and buy tickets at baldmove.com/live.
Cincinnati's actually a pretty great city to visit, and we've got lots of details for side adventures on our event page as well. The Reds are playing the Boston Red Sox in their fantastic Riverside Stadium. the thrills of King's Island just minutes away, and I'll be leading a kayak trip down the scenic Little Miami River on Saturday.
Again, get full details and get your tickets now on our Badass Fest 6 page at baldmove.com/live. Here are the highlights coming up this week on Bald Move.
We've got lots of ongoing coverage this week, from book versus show comparisons for Hot D to the latest very special episode of Why is Mr. Feeny a Car? But there are a couple of main events this week you need to know about.
Firstly, we've got a brand new commission podcast out this Tuesday covering the Raid 2, sometimes subtitled Retaliation. If you're a fan of martial arts films, this is one you don't want to miss. Iko Uwe is a rising star in the action movie world, and it's easy to see why. Join us on Tuesday as we dive into the bigger, badder sequel to The Raid, try and figure out which is better.
Then on Thursday, we're covering the season finale of Hulu's excellent period drama, Shogun. We've been waiting all season to see what Toranaga Sama's plan is, or if he even has one. It all comes down to this, and we couldn't be more excited. Join us on Thursday for what's sure to be an epic Shogun season finale podcast, and to find out if we plan to cover any related materials.
You can find these and many other great podcasts by searching for Bald Move Pulp or Bald Move Prestige in your favorite podcast app.
As far as housekeeping, Bald Move is all Game of Thrones all the time now. Sunday night, instant take. Tuesday night, main cast. Tuesday afternoon. Friday afternoon, spoiler edition. Which, you know, adventuresome book reader or show watchers are welcome. You can't be too spoiler-phobe. We're not going to talk about just naked show spoilers, but there is a lot of still stuff, hints and prophecies in the books that have not had a full fulfillment, and there might be some stuff you'll learn there. So if you're a complete spoiler-phobe, miss it. But if you're fairly adventuresome, you can check it out. We also have Dunkirk. Mm-hmm. The latest by Inception, Memento Man. I'm stalling because I've... Oh, Christopher Nolan. his World War II epic that we're going to be looking at on Thursday night. We'll have a podcast out before Thursday night is over. We have just a spoiler-free review and discussion of upcoming movies. And then we also have a spoiler-filled review for the club members at club.baldmove.com. Also for club members, tomorrow is Bad Guy Javi, the finale, the thrilling climax of Telltale Season 3 playthrough that we've done. How low can we sink? How bad can we make Javi go when we're on Telltale's rails? The answer might surprise you. Look at how you have you ever seen clickbait in a podcast? There's nothing to click on.
Right.
Top 7 terrible things Javi did in this season of Walking Dead. I also have a Twin Peaks podcast. I'm recording that with Shane Bowman tonight. I know I said that was last week, but Freak Electrical Storm took out Shane's power and we were sat down to record it. So that's very Twin Peaks. But that'll come out sometime this week, too. So that's what's going on at baldmove.com.
We start off with Walder Frey having gathered the entire family of Freys for a feast.
Yeah.
And he poisons them all and then, surprise, surprise, pulls off his face to reveal that it's been Arya the entire time.
Right.
This, like I said, is a cold open. I've really felt like Arya mastered the Walder much better than I did at the Red Wedding ceremony.
Mm.
She's got it down. Like, she even turns to the daughter, and instead of like, hey, I'm trying to spare you.
Right.
Don't drink the wine. It's poisoned. It's like, no, there's a dirty whore woman. I'm not going to give her my wine.
Right, right.
Like, she's got the attitude.
Arya doesn't break character until the commentary.
No.
Or until every last chicken in the room is dead. I feel like that we're going to see memes of this for generations to come, to leave the one wolf alive and the sheep are never safe.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, we're going to see a lot of mix-ups of wolves and Arya and that quote with cool gothic Game of Thrones font, and it's going to be on Facebook and
T-shirts.
Probably
and
a minion will be saying it before too long.
Yeah,
but I liked it. I thought that David, they mentioned this in the, you know, the behind the scenes, but David Bradley, who plays Walder Frey, I think did a particularly fine job of, you know, kind of blending the Arya with the Walder.
Yeah.
until at the end, and like the Arya, as she saw the poison take effect, was more and more brazen about. And mm-hmm. I thought I always am tickled when I see like Ewan McGregor doing a McGinnis impersonation. I don't know why,
right.
That, but anytime I see a famous person being given an impression of another famous person, it mm-hmm. always seems like a magic trick.
Yeah,
and this is a particularly good one.
Yeah.
What do you say to the idea that this would have been a hell of a lot more powerful without the Arya reveal of last season?
The Arya reveal? Oh, where she was the woman who brought the pie in.
Right. Because that was one of the recurring the criticisms and the feedback. The fact that... Now, I don't know whether I'm just dumb or willing to go with the shows, but I when this thing opened up, I thought it was either going to be a flashback mm-hmm. to establish context of what was about to happen, or potentially Bran like catching up on current events that he might have missed.
Yeah, I was with you. I was on flashback mode, flashback
right.
watch.
Right.
And when it turned out to be, you know, Arya in present day, I right. was happy.
I mean, I was keyed into his, to what was going on before she ripped her face off. But so that's the thing. If you were on this from the jump, then mm-hmm. maybe it was tedious. But maybe. I wasn't. I was fooled.
I was too. Now I do hope that they don't go to this well too many times, because
right.
that's the danger here. Is
it could get Mission Impossible-y real quick.
Yeah, I mean, this is my fear of fantasy, where essentially there's magic and
yep.
they hand wave the rules
yep.
away and say this happened, just deal with it.
Especially poorly defined magic,
which
such
is
as
what we have here with the faces.
The faces,
yeah.
Men. Yeah, yeah.
So they either need to not do this very often at all,
uh-huh.
or they need to more clearly define those rules
right.
for the faces, and then I'll be on board.
Right. I mean, it'd be awesome to have a scene where like Arya meets with the brothers and sisters, and they're like, "Oh, this is sweet. Just march up to Cersei as Jaime and put a knife right in her between her bazooms." And she's like, "Eh, it doesn't work that way because X, Y, Z."
Yeah.
That just defining limits on this power would be nice, because otherwise, I think you're going to get Arya ripping off to Tom Cruise, who rips off his face to L. Ron Hubbard, and
mm-hmm.
then what? Xenu's next.
Yep.
But yeah, it was. I thought it was a great scene.
Yeah. So the White Walkers continue.
Oh, wait.
Yeah.
Can we talk about the map? Because there's a lot of new things about the map. Number one, the Citadel, which I don't believe we've ever seen before.
Oh, the intro. Yeah, yeah.
But the fact that we didn't have to jump across to the Narrow Sea to Essos, or mm-hmm. do we have to go to the Dorne,
right.
Made things a lot... Like, they really remixed the intro, and there's a lot of different beats that are remixed because the camera movements were entirely different. So I felt like this is the most different credit sequence we've ever saw. Rarely seen things like Dragonstone and Twins, plus the new Citadel, plus the lack of, you know, the camera just jumping all over the world, I thought was pretty cool.
Yeah, I was watching that thinking, oh, there's a new town, Old Town. And
right.
I wasn't sure about that because Sam got there last year,
right.
and I was like, was it on the intro last
year? I don't think it was.
I didn't remember seeing it, but
I could be wrong. I also think that the tower, the Citadel's lighthouse, looks so much like the Tower of Barad-dûr from the
Lord of the Rings. Yeah,
like especially that nighttime shot.
Uh-huh.
I was about to be like, Sam, I see you, and you know, there's going to be a whole bunch of fucking hobbits running around.
Yeah,
little Lord of the Ringy. I'm surprised that got that far in. Well, that we actually saw it before anyone being like, can we make it a little less the Black Tower?
Yeah.
Because it looks less like a welcoming beacon and more like a baleful red eye that sees all.
Sure.
All right.
So then we go over to White Walkers. They're continuing their march south, and we see, they have giant whites.
Yes.
Which tells me that this wall is fucked.
Yeah.
Like, if with a full, you know, complement, such as it is,
right.
of soldiers at Castle Black, mm-hmm. they were able to fend off two giants.
Right. And mortal giants.
They have
giants
at least
at that.
Three. Right. Mortal giants. They have at least three here. Castle Black's not what it used to be, and that's not saying much.
Yeah.
I don't know about this wall, man. I don't know about the wall. Although Tormund's headed up there, so maybe he can do some damage.
It'd be cool if the ice zombies, the ice giant zombies formed, like you had five of them, they formed into like a Voltron.
Oh, God.
Like you know, they bite, two giants bite the hands, other giants bite the feet. I mean, they're zombies. Why couldn't they? They have an unlimited pain threshold.
That's true.
And, you know, a probably commiserate bite force grip. I want to see I want to see a Devastator.
Might get that. You
ice
might get
zombie.
Your wish.
1-1 will form the head once they get to Winterfell.
Yep. Anything else on that scene?
No.
It was cool looking, that's for sure. Those giants look creepy.
Well, and they let the scene breathe because it was like 2 minutes long of just the Ice King, like, remember me?
Yeah,
and what it's all about, guys.
Traveling through, the cloud of cold, essentially,
right,
it comes through. I like that. Then we go to Mira and Bran arriving at the wall, where they convince Ed to let them into the Castle Black with a warning that winter is coming. Bran essentially has to say, like, I know what you did last summer.
Exactly.
and they let him in.
Yeah, it seems foolish for old Ed, Lord Commander Ed, to do that since, you know, all the glamoring and face swapping and green seeing and leading into fires. Like, anybody could have that information.
Yeah. I really didn't know what it proved.
Right.
Like, unless you've got a birthmark you can show me.
Right.
Shaped like a direwolf, I don't want any of it.
Yeah.
Not going to hear it. Then Jon tells everyone that they need to find, mine, and make weapons from dragonglass, and that they need to train everyone, not just the men, to fight. He sends the free folk north to defend the wall. Eastwatch by the Sea, I guess, is the castle closest to Hardhome.
Mm-hmm.
When he declares that he won't strip the surviving Umbers and Karstarks of their lands, Sansa publicly questions his leadership. Then Jon asks the Umbers and Karstarks to repledge their houses to him, and they do so.
On subsequent watches, I was really paying attention to the level of murmuring and applause. Because I was looking for hints that, like, maybe John made the wrong decision. But it seems like getting a refreshed oath of loyalty from Ned and Elise Umber and Karstark, respectively, was a real crowd pleaser.
Yeah.
The North liked it.
I think so. And certainly the Umbers and Karstarks, which I have to say, is he just trying to recruit a new family? Because this girl looks exactly like Sansa, and the kid might look like Rickon. Like,
a little bit.
I really think he's just trying to get a new family.
A little bit. I did like there was a couple other details that the internet was quick to point out, like the fact that they've kept the Umber sword consistent. It's got that little motif of the two rings at the end of its hilt. Or cross guard, rather. And that was like goes all the way back to season one of The Great John. So I thought that was pretty cool. And I also like I feel like that both John and Sansa have a point here.
Mm-hmm.
Because Sansa's point of like if there's no punishment for treason and no reward for loyalty, then what the fuck?
Sure. I just think she's off base. I think he did reward or he hasn't rewarded loyalty yet, but the treason couldn't be punished.
I mean,
the punishment was already complete in that they died.
Yeah.
You know, like did these kids the
well, and you can see where that
and what's her name?
Yeah, and you can see where that would appeal especially to John, who has been punished for the sins of his father, quote unquote, many times in his life. I just thought that I was surprised. I mean, I also get John's point of like, hey, can you not publicly question my leadership?
Right.
But I also thought that I don't know. Maybe a rejoinder to that would be, maybe him and Sansa should have had a little bit more of a talk before they came to this war council and started discussing stuff. And I think that John would be wise to listen to some of Sansa's more real politic takes on things.
Yeah,
because we've said often in this podcast is how fucking dumb, how deep the stupidity runs in the Stark family. It's not a popular sentiment, but I think it's true, and I think it's canon that the Starks are naive and they trust overmuch in words and oaths and allegiances where they shouldn't.
Yeah, it's interesting because I think I agree with John's leadership choice here, but I don't think I agree with the way he's conducting himself. Sort of behind the scenes with Sansa. Like, they don't seem to be having the conversations. Like,
exactly.
Make a choice. Is she going to be part of this leadership or not?
Yeah.
And if she's not, then don't have her sitting up at that table with you.
Yeah, and it reminds me a lot of, like, Rob's relationship with his mother.
Mm-hmm.
Like, you know, Kat wasn't exactly the wisest of people at all times either, but I felt like she was giving some really good advice to Rob that he largely ignored to his peril.
Yeah.
She did some crazy stuff too, like taking upon herself to set free Jaime, and there's a lot of missteps that she took too, but you know, part of that was probably because she felt like, you know, she wouldn't
desperate.
She was desperate, she didn't think Rob would go for it, and she didn't want her family. I understand, but it does seem like the Starks could use with a little bit of, you know, getting some private counsel before you address everybody in Maas.
Yeah. I think Sansa's points are also valid. Like, yes. There are things that he needs to consider. But she doesn't know if he has considered them because she hasn't had a discussion with him. And that's the most important thing.
Right. Are you liking Miss Mormont more this season?
Not really, no. Yeah. She's still a little too authoritative for my taste.
She's the internet's darling.
Yeah, I guess so. And at the end of the scene, there's a look from Littlefinger, which looks like he has spotted an opportunity, which he tries to capitalize on later, and it doesn't go so well.
We will see. We will see.
Yeah. So Jon tells Sansa not to question his orders in public again. There's this whole discussion up on the bridge. She says she wants him to be smarter than Ned and Rob so he won't die. And a message arrives from Cersei demanding Jon's loyalty. And Sansa warns Jon that Cersei is more of a threat than she seems. I like the finger pointing here. No, you're just like Joffrey. No, you're just like Cersei.
Right, right. Like,
come on.
Right. It would be, yeah, you're right. There's a symmetry there that's not, it seems like, it seems like the writers aren't necessarily playing fair because they're given... And I don't know if that's deliberate because, you know, one of the big fears I have is that Sansa is going to revert to form and, you know, deal with her brother treacherously, and that's going to lead ultimately to her downfall. Because they have a good point. They have good points. Like, you know, Jon is scared to death of the Night King because he's met them and he sees what he can do.
Yeah.
Sansa's scared to death of Cersei because she lived under, you know, her rule and mismanagement, and she knows what she's capable of, and her point of... I mean, they both have good points. Like, there's already the wall.
Yeah.
Like, you know, the wall will protect us from the north, but there's nothing to the south. And then, of course, you know, again, Jon's got a good point where, like, well, there's 1,000 miles of brutal winter ruggedness between us and the Lannisters, so... Mm-hmm. Which is the bigger threat, and it kind of comes down to their own familiarity, which seems like it's true to life.
I think so. They both have experience with different things.
Did you notice Sansa's hair?
What about it?
A lot of people put it at the fact that she's got, during the scene where she is talking about looking up to Cersei, or at least learning things from Cersei, that she's wearing Cersei's hairstyle that she had up until she got her hair chopped off.
I don't remember what it was.
The twin braids pulled back, yeah.
Okay.
I thought that was it's either foreshadowing or it's the writers and the costuming people wanting us to worry about Sansa.
Yeah,
because I'm a little worried about her.
I am too, but maybe not for the reasons that everybody else is.
Okay.
We'll get to that here in a couple scenes, but first we're going over to Cersei. She's painted a new map on the ground in the courtyard.
Mm-hmm.
She's preparing for war, it appears. She tells Jaime that Tyrion's working with Dany, and they're on their way to take the throne, and asks him how they should proceed with securing their dynasty. Jaime says they have to secure allies, but Cersei's already working on it. Then we'll get to her ally here in a second.
Yeah, I thought it was interesting that Cersei deliberately used, like, every gendered slur you can against women, like Ilaria Sand and her brood of bitches, Olenna's the old cunt, Sands is the murdering whore. It's like, woo, 3 for 3.
Yeah, you don't want to hear what people would say about you, Cersei.
Right, is there like a tripart portmanteau that we can just put all those...
Right.
Banor, she's a Banor. I thought in subsequent watches, Jaime's relationship with Cersei is very much like a smaller male spider approaching the large. Because it made a little bit more sense that I don't think he's completely on board with Cersei, but he's looking at like, okay, I've already thrown away my entire honor to keep this damn city from being burnt up. I now have a Mad Queen situation. I just can't come in there. You know, she's got the mountain. I can't come in there with my offhand and sword her to death. And I'm not saying even think, but he's trying to do, I think, what he thinks is right for the realm in the hand that they're dealt.
Mm-hmm.
Because, you know, like Jaime tries to go to the one thing that's her, you know, like Tyrion said, you've got two redeeming qualities, your cheekbones and your love for your children.
Mm-hmm.
Jaime goes to that well and she shuts it down. Tommen betrayed me with his suicide, which... That actually kind of like made me take a step back and like, wow, Cersei, that's now she's just got the cheekbones.
Yeah, the way she views this whole situation is crazy to me.
Yeah,
and I don't know. They're gonna have to do a little bit more with Jaime and Cersei's relationship. I do like like you said earlier, how he's kind of tiptoeing around the situation. And it becomes even more apparent in this next scene with Euron, right?
Mm-hmm.
Maybe we should get there. Cersei and Jaime are watching the Greyjoy fleet sail into the bay, and Jaime's questioning whether they can trust him. Once he lands, Euron trades some words with Cersei and Jaime before being turned away when he proposes an alliance. And he vows to return with a priceless gift to win the alliance. So throughout the conversation here, the thing I love about it is he's constantly taking digs at Jaime.
Mm-hmm.
Right, like, I'm here with a fleet and two good hands.
Right.
Jaime looks over at Cersei like, are you buying this shit?
Yeah.
And then he says, you should try murdering your brother. It feels great.
Uh-huh. Uh-huh.
And Jaime's like, his eyes bug out of his head. Really?
Yeah, like every single
You're
time
let this slide?
Like Jaime mugs at the camera like a wiggle wiggle what? You know? Right. What's going on?
Oh, it's so good.
But then again, to be fair, Jaime's given as good as he gets. Like, he says that the Iron Islanders are a bitter little people who can steal things. They only steal things they can't build themselves.
Mm-hmm.
I guess I can build 1,000 warships.
Holy shit, those boats are awesome.
The boats are awesome looking, and I'm wondering what the hell is going on with that little thing they got up front.
Are they
the jaws of life looking thing?
I was going to say, are they meant to ram other boats and take the impact?
I don't know if that's like seizes its boat and its jaws, and then they just storm it, or like it's going to the. I mean,
dragon catchers.
I would think that the naval battle would be amazing, except for it seems like, air superiority is the death of a naval fleet, and Dany's got it.
She does.
So I even with does Dany got 100 or 300 ships? I feel like she's got like 300 ships. So even with a 3-to-1 numerical superiority, it feels like the dragons are just going to be the equalizer.
They should be, yeah.
But I don't know. They're wanting it to be a big threat.
Yeah, I guess the one thing that the Iron Islanders probably have going for them, Euron and Cersei, I guess, is surprise, right?
Mm-hmm.
Like, I suppose they don't know that they've got the fleet yet.
That's true.
So maybe they can
be a Pearl Harbor situation.
Yeah, like trap them in Blackwater Bay or something.
While the dragons are still on the landing strips, just bomb them.
Right, yeah. They're waking up. I haven't had my coffee yet. I haven't had my 6 sheep for the day.
They like a hot. They like a McDonald's drive-through window hot.
They do.
Cersei
also has a terrible poker face.
Well,
you can see her getting like visibly wet when Euron's like,
right.
I've got a fleet. And he describes the fleet, and she's just up there licking her lips.
Because Cersei's flaw, she can only see... She's like a chess player that only plays her side of the board.
Mm-hmm.
She can only see the brilliant maneuvers unfolding. She doesn't understand the opponent and that they take extra steps and you have to think about those. It's just like, oh, I've got this ace in the hole.
Yeah.
What could possibly... Now, I also thought it was interesting there's no mention of dragons when she's talking about her threats. Surely she has to know. I mean, if you haven't heard that the dragons, like, turn the tide at the battle marine... but I thought it was interesting that there was like really no mention of that.
Who does she have informing her anymore? I guess Qyburn still has birds,
and he's,
right?
Yeah, and plus this isn't like presidential daily briefing shit. This is like front page of Westerosi News.
Yeah,
Dragons Reborn, Torch Marine.
It's pretty important.
Slaver's Bay no longer Slaver's Bay. What do you think is the gift that he will not return to King's Landing without? That was. 50 people in my email box wanting to know what we thought the gift was going to be.
People were talking about a horn. People are talking about all kinds of stuff. Crap, I can't remember what the other thing I read was.
I mean, it seems like one of the things, because what do we know in the show that Cersei's been, they've kind of gotten away with this last few seasons, but she was all about, collecting dwarf heads.
Oh, right.
So, like, Tyrion's head would be a suitable gift.
How do you get Tyrion? I mean, it seems like you just have to win the war.
Right. Right. Some people suggested that he would bring, Yara and Theon prisoner, which I would understand why that would be good for him, but why does Cersei care that he settled his... I don't feel like that's a precious gift to her.
Mm-hmm.
That's like, he went and bought a bowling ball for her because he really is into bowling.
What about...
it's for you, though, honey. Right. I didn't spend this money myself. It's for you. It's a Homer Simpson
gambit. I'll just borrow it on the weekends.
Right, right.
Yeah, so what about... what's her name? Sand.
Oh, Laria.
Laria Sand, mm-hmm. Yeah. What about her? for having killed Myrcella.
Or, I guess, yeah, like, all of the... of all the femme fatales that are arrayed against Cersei, that Olenna or Alaria would be something that would make Cersei sit up and take notice.
Yeah,
I think that's a lot more likely than the Greyjoy family.
Yeah, I'm with you. And now Olenna, Cersei somehow still thinks she might be on their side.
That was a real weird line of dialogue. I thought it was maybe like, even if you can somehow bring the, but yeah, because I don't get it. Like, you know, does she think that maybe she can like promise Tyrell to a couple powerful houses? Like, for example, most powerful house in the Reach that's not the Tyrells or the Tarleys.
Okay.
So, like, could she go to Randall Tarly, who's recently lost his Valyrian steel sword, and be like, hey. You do what's right by the crown, and we'll make you the new stewards of Highgarden.
I mean, if that's what she's thinking, it's so naive.
Right.
She just murdered her entire family.
And that's one of the tragedies, I think, of the War of the Five Kings, is the fact that this happened right on the cusp of winter, when people should have been getting grain in their silos and being fattened up their livestock and preparing for winter. This is all just been like a fucking horde of locusts have gone over the land, and it's just bare cupboards everywhere. So
yeah.
Even if they could do that, is it too late to provide for everybody?
It might be.
I mean, even the Lannister troops, we found out a few years back that, according to Papa Lannister, according to Tywin, they're broke anyway.
Yeah.
And we start to see evidence of that, like these well-equipped, well-trained soldiers heading north, but they've got a rabbit to share between the 10 of them.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you know, it doesn't sound like they have enough food either. So that's the economics of these wars. I like it being brought to the forefront a bit.
Yeah, it's cool. Then we see Sam's daily routine. It's humiliating. It's disgusting.
And the grandiose Citadel music that introduces the shit montage is pretty good.
Yeah.
Oh, God, and his retching.
His retching. The firm amongst the soup. Like, it's disgusting. We also see him eyeing the books in the restricted area of the library.
Sure.
And then during a human dissection, which is like, they're weighing organs. They're, I guess, doing research here.
Yeah.
Sam reiterates to one of the maesters his desire to get access to that area so that he can learn how to stop the White Walkers. The maester tells him not to worry about the impending doom because every winter is ended. And Sam steals the keys and then steals a bunch of books from the restricted area.
Yeah, I thought it was interesting, the Archmaester's take that, like, we are different and we lead these separate lives because we're the world's memory. Without us, men would be... no more than dogs. They, you know, have no concept of time, and they just repeat their own mistakes. And I thought that's an interesting contrast, that this is a very secularized view of the world, contrasting to the three-eyed raven, which seemed to be the children of the forest answer to this memory of the world. Like, you have these mystic shaman that have this connection to the land, and they can go back and peer into history, and you don't like you know, men of science build the citadel and they house books and towers, and children of faith you know, have people plugged into the Weirwood network.
Mm-hmm.
But I found throughout this episode there's all these different contrasts, you know, between like John and Sansa, Cersei and Daenerys, the way of the Citadel versus the way of the Children of the Forest. I thought that was pretty cool.
Yeah, and it's actually what he's saying here is sort of ironic when you look at the Hound and what his arc has been, you know? Like, talking about being no more than dogs and not having a memory and thinking only of the last meal and the next. We definitely see, not a reckoning, but an owning up to the Hound's actions in this episode. So, I don't know. He seems to be learning from his mistakes.
Indeed.
But yeah, that's an interesting philosophy. The idea that they're sort of like the memory banks of this computer that is the world.
Right.
And you just can't function very well without it. Anything else on this?
Nah, whatever. Let's move on.
Okay, Pod and Brienne are fighting, and Tormund gets jealous. I actually like this a lot. Pod seems to be fighting a little dirty, like sort of like Bronn taught him. You know, he's learning some lessons that he
took advantage
have.
Of the opening,
right?
And then Brienne just beats the holy hell out of him.
Yeah, thrown into the mud. And then Littlefinger tries to give Sansa some counsel, but she shuts him down. And Brienne asks why he's still here. Sansa said he saved us,
and that's the uncomfortable fact.
Well, yeah,
the fact that Jon you know, for all of his talk about, you know, the fact that by right as king he's making all these decisions, if it weren't for Sansa and especially Littlefinger, the Boltons would still be ruling Winterfell and all the Starks would be dead.
Yeah. Now, they could have maybe had a conversation, like we said last season, about, sure, you know, Littlefinger's right, going to swoop in, save the day, buddy. Don't
but
worry.
Now, I mean, I've already seen enough from Jon that I kind of am a bit more on Sansa's side, because, like, what if Jon's be like, we can't trust Littlefinger, blah, 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 and, you know, does something to... I don't know how he would fuck that up, that last minute of alliance, but I don't know. He's got just enough pig-headed Ned Stark in him to... I think that Sansa's right to be worried. I'm not defending that choice, but I guess I understand it more.
Yeah, and I'm also seeing the Ned in Sansa as well.
How so?
She seems to be keeping a dangerous and untrustworthy person around simply because of loyalty, of honor.
Oh, right.
Of a debt
the little finger thing to be like, thanks for your armies.
Right.
Now
we don't need you anymore.
Right.
Get out of here because you're going to try and influence me.
Yeah, I'm going to get a personal oath of loyalty from Jon Royce over here, and then you'll be gone.
Yeah, but she's keeping around out of some kind of thanks, I guess.
Yeah. Well, I bet
that seems dangerous.
If I do my math right, Littlefinger controls the Sweet Robin. Mm-hmm. Who is the rightful, although terrible, leader of the Vale right now. And Jon Royce takes his vow seriously enough that I don't think that he would just swear allegiance. Like he's allied to Jon, but he's not going to swear his allegiance. So I guess Littlefinger still has the armies of the Vale, which are at least half of Jon's forces that he's going to need for the war north. So I don't know. It's the Littlefinger's game here. I feel like this is the most... He's climbed his rings of chaos far enough that now he can't see. I don't know that he has the next move. I think he might be waiting for something else to happen.
I think I know what his next move is going to. Well, I don't know what it's going to be, but I think he's at a pivotal point where he has to change his strategy. Mm-hmm. I think he's seen that Sansa is not going to let him in. Is not going to take his counsel or marry him or whatever the fuck he wants. I think Littlefinger is going to pivot, and I don't know what avenue he's going
to
go down.
He's got his choice of queens he could pivot to. He could go back to Cersei, and you know, I don't know how he would win her back because he promised her Sansa's head. Mm-hmm. Or he's got Daenerys he could make a play with, like, hey, I've got yet another kingdom I could give to you wholesale, which would be very attractive to a person like Dany, I would think.
Yeah. I don't know. We'll see. So we go over to Arya. She happens upon some singing Lannister troops in the woods who invite her to share their food. She's wary, but eventually warms up to them after they start talking about their mission and their families and joking. And these seem to be the good Lannister troops. Mm-hmm. I guess not all Lannister troops are bad.
I felt they went a bit overboard.
You think so?
Like, well, they found the wokest camp of Lannisters the world's ever seen. Not just like, oh, my mother's trying me to be kind to strangers and to... And we're just here to send a peace for shit that you fucked up. But then, like, oh, I want a girl because nothing good comes from guys in this kingdom. Like, come on.
I almost felt like they had to go that far because I was very much like Arya at the beginning of this scene. I'm like, I'm very wary, right? I stumble upon this group of Lannister troops.
Right.
I'm looking around for the swords. I'm worried about the song they're singing. I'm very skittish. And I feel like if they didn't go quite as far as they did, they might not have sold me on the idea that these are mostly harmless troops to Arya.
I also like her, I'm going to kill the king, which everybody cracked up at. I think it's the first time we've heard Maisie Williams laugh since she lost her shit with the Hound at the Gate of the Eyrie. I don't know. Like, the other thing I surprised is how much the internet seemed to collectively dislike Ed Sheeran's guest star.
It was fine. As someone who doesn't know who Ed Sheeran is, no problem.
And I think
with
that's
whatsoever.
The key, because, like, say they made Florence Welch of Florence and the Machine a Red Priestess.
Right.
I would recognize her, but how many people would? And, you know, like, I think if you do recognize him, they did make him the focal point of so many shots that it probably was very distracting, because one of the charms of Game of Thrones has been, other than, like, you know, Sean Bean and... I'm trying to think of maybe a couple others, really relatively famous people.
Peter Dinklage.
Peter Dinklage, yeah. But was he that famous? Like if you, you
that's
know,
a good question.
You
yeah,
probably knew him fair. As the guy from Elf, and but like right. it's not like he was, you know, burning up. What was that one he was in the train station movie?
Yeah, Train Spotting. No, I don't remember the name of it.
Yeah, but I mean, like, I'm not saying he wasn't doing excellent work. I'm just saying I don't think he was a household name. And you could almost say the same thing about like Aidan Gillian, Littlefinger,
the station agent.
Station Is agent. That, that's what it yeah, was. Okay. For the most part, these people were relatively unknown. So like, you could just like, oh yep, that's John Stark or that's Sansa or whatever. You know, you can't do that yeah. if you know who Ed Sheeran is. So,
so let me ask you this. Ed Sheeran is like the scruffy-headed blonde boy,
yes,
right?
Yes, he is.
That doesn't have many lines.
Right.
So I like that they didn't make him the focus of the scene.
Right. Because
clearly the taller, like, hair-pulled-back, dark-haired guy mm-hmm. is like the focus of the scene. He has yeah. the most dialogue and everything.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, he was just a minor bit in a show that is 73 hours long. Are you yeah. really that worried about it?
Hey, man, people get their suspension of disbelief all fucked up over
yeah, weird, that's true.
Weird stuff. And, like, I'm not going to criticize because it happens to me, too.
Yeah.
And, again, like, someone in the feedback was making a comment, like, what would you think if, like, Taylor Swift had been in that role? Like, where she's like, oh, it's a new song. Do you like it? Wink. I mean, like, I guess a sufficiently big pop star would. And I guess that's the argument, right? To the people who know who Ed Sheeran, and he's not sure. an unknown. Like, maybe the safer thing would just be not to do that.
Yeah. But they've already done that, right?
Like, I don't need
Braun is a pop star in the UK. Like, or
is
was
he?
A pop star.
Yeah.
Kind yeah, of I mean, he had like, a big hit. Sure, but that's like. I'm trying to think of a
he's the pop star from Love Actually. Like, I don't know.
Right.
The kids know who he is.
Sure.
Anyway. Plus, we're probably pissing off all the English people because they're like, oh, he's a fucking national treasure. He's a fucking treasure.
Is. He should be.
Yeah.
He's awesome. all right. The Hound, Beric, and Thoros ride up on the house where the Hound killed a man, stole his silver, and left his daughter to die.
He didn't kill the
couple
man.
Of seasons
he,
ago.
He mugged her. You, I think you misinterpreted
yeah,
the
he,
previously on.
He
But left
wounded him and
yeah,
essentially killed him.
The Hound was under no illusions about this family's fate.
Yeah,
so
he sees their bodies there in the house. The Hound begins to shit on Beric's religion and his mission until Thoros calls him over to the fire and he sees a vision of his own of the wall being overtaken by White Walkers.
That's not all. You know what else he saw in that fire?
What?
A mountain.
Yeah, yeah. So this is interesting. I do want to talk about the language here. A mountain, something that looks like an arrowhead.
It's the mountain's penis.
Right? It's as pointy as can be.
Yeah,
and Kyber the dead just, marching
Kyber constant. Just used the broken shaft of Oberyn's spear to piece it back together. but, I mean, is this not the Clegane Bowl, the hype of old?
It certainly could
we
be.
Thought, we thought it was slain, but it's back. It's back.
It certainly could be, yeah. I want to throw out another proposal.
Maybe the arrowhead is a joke about the Hound's new helmet. Because, like I said,
the mountain's new helmet.
Yeah, yeah. He's very circumcised penis looking.
Very much, yeah.
I don't know why. There's another one, right? I don't know how that got past. Like, you know, like you parade the different types, and it's like, well, obviously this one looks like a uncircumcised or circumcised penis.
Mm-hmm.
Get it out of here.
Yep.
I get it that the Cersei's going to go towards Darth Vader fashion, but come on. And it slipped through the cracks.
Everybody's going toward Darth Vader fashion.
Mm-hmm.
Cersei, Dany.
Yeah.
Everybody's in dark, drab apparel.
Yeah. A lot of people were not liking Euron's The Crow outfit
oh,
either.
Jesus,
it is,
yeah.
It is an unfortunately dark palette. And I wonder, yeah. I mean, I saw that happen with the Harry Potter films as they got more adult. Like, they just got more and more desaturated in the color and... I don't know if that's always a wise choice because, mm-hmm. you know, one of the nice things about the show is it always did have a very pleasing palette and it was nice to look at. And if they have yeah. to drain all the color out of the world to sell me that this is adult and dark story now, eh.
Yeah. I mean, they're doing it from both sides, right? They're,
yeah.
All the darks are getting darker. The whites are getting whiter. It's going to be very contrasty.
Yep.
But let's talk about the mountain. Let me throw out another proposal. Later in the episode, Sam talks about a mountain of dragon glass.
Sure.
Outside of Dragonstone. And he, you know, we see people using dragon glass for arrowheads. It could definitely be that he's talking about the dragon glass here.
Yeah. I think that's probably what's more likely.
Yeah. Okay.
But you thought it was, I also thought it was interesting the fact that the Hound is able to interpret fires.
Yeah. That's not something everyone can do.
Or maybe they can. Maybe just bother to look.
I think a lot more people would be having a lot more visions then.
So what's special about him? And I thought it's interesting that they brought out the irony of him banding with a bunch of fire worshippers since he's deathly afraid of fire due to his older brother Mountain burning his face off when he was a kid.
Yeah.
I thought it was all good, but it was a little, I guess, jarring to see him, you know, conversing with the Lord of the Light, I guess.
Yeah, it's another one of those things where it's not well-defined, and I'm not certain who can do it, why it happens, anything like that. It's just apparent that it did happen to him.
Yeah.
I don't think he's a great traveling companion. We saw him with Arya. You know, he was not nice to her.
No.
We've now seen him with Beric and Thoros. He's even worse to them.
Right.
Like, he is just a grumpy Gus, not having any of it.
He is, yeah. I mean, maybe that's, like, the fact that you look like your face is half hamburger, maybe you get that as an early. You just go hard on people's top knots.
It's a defense mechanism.
And they're missing eyes, and they're whatever you can go after them, because you want to launch an offensive so they know that, like, well, if I talk shit back, he's going to eat my chicken.
Yeah.
And that'll be that.
Indeed. So then he digs a grave to put the farmer and his daughter in. The Hound tries to pray over him, but he doesn't remember the words. So he settles for, "You deserve better."
I like this as a good, as both a character moment and also some raw meat to the book readers, because we pinned our hopes on Sandor not being dead because of this elaborate gravedigger theory.
Mm-hmm.
And now we see the Hound actually digging graves.
Yeah.
So well played, Double D's, well played.
Nice nod to it. I also like, you know, how well this scene serves to remind us how far the Hound has come.
Yes.
To show the change in his character. It's the
He's still an asshole, but
he's
troubled by it. He's troubled by it now.
He is, yeah.
And also, he can't ask uncomfortable questions about how the Lord of Light is using Beric Dondarrion without thinking about how it applies to him as well.
Right.
Like, why are you still alive? Why you know, why am I still alive? Why am I being chosen? Like, I'm, you know, if I'm more exceptional than Beric, it's because of the bad things I've done, not the good things I've done in life.
Yeah.
So, again, a nice little symmetry that they've set up between the two.
How many scoops did you think it took for the Hound to dig that grave?
At least two. And also,
the Mountain could have done it in one, I think.
He's the grave backhoe. I don't know. And like digging through frozen mud can't be fun.
No.
Cannot be fun.
All right, let's go back over to Sam. He's reading the books he stole, and he comes across a map of Dragonstone that shows the location of a dragonglass mine, or a mountain, as he describes it.
Mm-hmm.
And he sends a raven off to Jon. Later, he's cleaning up the dungeons, and Jorah shoves someone I assume is Jorah. We never see his face, but we hear his voice. He shoves his scaly arm out a door.
Not practicing safe hand grabbing.
Not at all. No.
Yeah. Put a glove on that thing. Glove up, man.
But he asks if Sam, if Danny has made it to Westeros yet.
Yeah.
No news.
So did you see all of the screen captures of these pages?
Sure.
There's a lot of interesting things you can mine here. Number one, in the pages he's flipping through is a very detailed picture of the dragon that the Cat's Paw used to hire to kill Bran back in season one used, which was a big CSI Winterfell kind of thing.
That's the blade?
Yeah, the Valyrian that cut Cat's hands, and it turns out it was belonged to maybe Tyrion, then Littlefinger. What do you make of the fact that that picture was prominently displayed on the page?
I don't know. Like, I really have no idea how this blade is going to factor in. Because
the thing is the consensus amongst people who have thought about the matter is that it was Joffrey that hired the person to kill Bran to try to impress his dad. That's the conclusion Tyrion came to. It's the conclusion Jaime comes to. The people in the in-universe that we respect as smart, perceptive people have looked at all the information. Now, that means that Littlefinger was not behind it, but he did stick his nose into there as his climbing the rungs of chaos thing.
Mm.
And I wonder if Sansa can use this to hang him by his own petard, so to speak. Because
maybe.
And it would be ironic that he actually goes down for something he did not, in fact, do.
Yeah, yeah.
I like
I like how poetic justice-y that is.
Like chaos catches up with him.
Yeah. Like, oh, you stuck your nose in this and you fomented chaos and you ended up, you know, having almost all my family murdered. Well, you know, here's this chaos coming back to take advantage of you.
If he's killed by Ian Malcolm, that's even more justice. yeah, so I don't know, like, how this information didn't seem to be important to Sam at all. And he's the only one who I guess would have that information in the moment.
Right.
How, I guess, do you see any way for it to get back to Sansa or Jon or Littlefinger even?
I don't know. Maybe if, like, because there was such close proximity to, like, the maps and stuff, like, maybe if, like, Sam is so brash as to rip pages out of the forbidden section of the library.
Ties the books to a raven's foot.
At least a couple pages. Like, that's a great question of, like, where it can all get connected. But, you know, we got a lot of characters moving around. We got a lot of jetpacks on the field.
Yeah.
I'm just saying it's significant that information showed up in such close proximity.
Absolutely.
The other thing that this was, like, on a half page that was obscured by the edge of the screen. But before Sam turned the page to the mountain of Dragonglass, there was a treatise where one of the maesters were talking about the alleged healing properties of Dragonglass, and that the Targaryens used to. So there's one thing that said that you could ingest. And again, you only got every other word, but like apparently you can ingest dragon's glass, and it's like a cure all.
Okay.
And it's interesting because what we know about Dragonstone is that that's where Stannis set up camp. We also know that his daughter had an intractable case of what do they call that? Stone skin?
Grayscale?
Huh? Yeah, grayscale. Thank you. Jesus, I'm the book reader here. saved by the show watcher. And that maybe there's this theory that Shireen, because she was dwelling on this island, it's chock full of dragon glass, that she got like some kind of proximity cure.
Huh.
And at that now, okay. I don't know to what end. Like,
or maybe a maester knew this, like,
right, and it's been forgotten, or you know, people just didn't take it serious because
Stannis went to the maesters, right?
It kind of, he went to all them. I just wonder if there's something to that, and it seems like pretty small potato stakes to heal Jorah, and to what end. But I thought that was interesting, and then finally, a lot of the commentary on those pages were about the fact that Valyrian steel seems to be connected to obsidian. Their dragon glass, because it said that the Valyrians used to adorn their like sword hilts and handles with it.
Yeah.
And people are thinking, and there's also the descriptions of how they use dragons to melt this glass together to form like their castles on old Valyria didn't have seams. Like they were just like perfect, smooth surfaces mated together because they'd have the dragons kind of weld it together.
Huh.
And they're cool. So that this goes more into our speculation preseason that Sam is going to discover something important about Valyrian steel, and that this might be this just a first step of that, because I think we agreed that it's underwhelming if he goes to the Citadel and all he finds out is something that Stannis told him as an aside 3 seasons ago.
Right. Yeah, I'm with you. I hope it's more than that. We'll see.
Right.
Jorah looks pretty bad, so I don't. I mean, if they're gonna do a cure,
that hand's pretty bad.
Yeah, they need to do it quick. So what is he – so I get that he comes here looking for a cure.
Right.
That makes a lot of sense to me.
That's what Danny gave him to do.
But why, I guess, are the maesters keeping him in this cell, just kind of keeping him around? Are they working on him?
I bet.
They're trying to fix him?
But it feels like this is like their quarantine area.
Okay.
And, you know, grayscale is it's kind of like the old school leprosy.
Yeah.
So
they probably just want to study him, honestly.
Right.
Like
yeah.
He's going to get dissected the moment
it doesn't
he
seem like it's a very hygienic.
No.
Yeah. Like this is just a dank, airless cell that they're waiting for you to die so they can dissect you, I guess.
I guess so.
So, but now that Sam's made this connection, I feel like that's. I don't know to what end because Jorah Restored is kind of who cares at this point.
Yep.
He was never the best fighter. I mean, he's most notable for his attraction to Dany. I think that's a one-sided attraction. I don't think that goes anywhere. Mm-hmm. But
could he maybe be like healed by a dragon glass and then go to Dany and say, "Hey, Dany, there's a whole bunch of dragon glass here. Look at the magical properties."
Sure.
Like,
look,
it cured me.
My hand.
Right. It's they chopped it off and they're studying it back at the Citadel. But It was cured before that.
Right. I don't know. I'll have more to say in the spoiler podcast Friday.
Cool. We go, speaking of Danny, to Danny's fleet arriving at Dragonstone. She's finally returning home. Mm-hmm. She takes her time, her sweet, sweet time, savoring her homecoming. And then instead of taking the throne, she immediately begins planning her conquest of Westeros. Mm-hmm. And if I'm Tyrion, if I'm Grey Worm, if I'm Missandei, I'm thinking, okay, like, we know this is your homecoming. This is the thing you've been waiting for, but can we get on with it, please?
Yeah.
Enough with the marveling already.
Uh-huh. I mean, I thought this worked reasonably well the first time. The second and third time I watched it, I'm like, wow, you mute this and take the music that's doing so much heavy lifting.
Yeah.
And I still think Emilia Clarke's not great. She's good. She's good at being amused, at being kind of bummed out. Mm-hmm. I wouldn't say even sad, but like if she sees a dead child, she expresses mild discontent at it. Uh-huh. She's good at being powerful, and she's good at being sexy. She's really good at being sexy and powerful.
Okay.
Like, you want a woman to strut out of fire and for a horde of Dothraki to throw themselves at her feet, Emilia Clarke's your woman.
Are you saying nuance is not her?
Yeah.
Subtlety is not what she's going for?
It really, like, when the director says, like, you know, gives her all this, like, this is your dream, Daenerys. This is your dream, Emilia. This is your setting foot on the place you were born. Mm-hmm. This is the thing your brother promised you, and now you've got it by your own right. And she just takes it, and it's a blank stare.
Yeah, I feel you on that. It's tough. I'm trying to get into the character's head and say, okay, what would cause a character to have this sort of blank slate look?
She's trying to be, and I get it. Like, you can say, well, she's trying to be queenly,
right? She's almost not allowing herself to feel this as much.
Like Queen Elizabeth landing on Dragonstone, she would just take her corgis, go sit on the throne. Everything would be like, she wouldn't be like, oh, Dragonstone, and weep and right. Gone her hand, you know, rip her dress and rub sand all over.
She might touch the sand. Maybe.
She might. Yeah, that's dignified. Uh-huh. But yeah, I mean, maybe that is like she's trying to keep the majesty and you know, like that's something Tyrion's been telling her. Like you have to have almost this inhuman detachment, and maybe Emilia Clarke's blank look is a little, you know, Natalie Portman episode one Star Wars thing where it's like the director doesn't really know what he wants out of her, and that's what he's getting. But
I don't know. I think season one, season two, uh-huh. Daenerys actually would do all the things you said. Like she would be loving this.
I think season one is the nadir. Like I really,
it's all downhill from there.
Yeah, her for the, like, especially when she was in, you know, full chattel mode. And I mean, there again, that could be a perfectly valid way to do a woman that has no agency. But then it's the exact same kind of like deer in the headlights look that we're getting when she is this powerful conqueror coming over to. I mean, to let us begin again, like when she switched into power mode, everything was clicked back into place. But boy, those 5 minutes where she's just walking around with the music swelling and she's tearing down banners and just gawking at things, not my favorite Daenerys.
Yeah.
Slightly above Where Are My Dragons, Daenerys, but, you know, it's nowhere near the unburnt version.
I think her mission has changed, you know. At first it was like, I want to return home. Her mission is definitely Westeros now. She wants to have Westeros.
Yeah.
Break the wheel, like she says. So,
and many, many people said that there is some obvious character development where she just bypasses the Throne of Dragons.
Yeah.
Like, I'm not even going to.
Absolutely.
I got my eyes on the prize.
And that's why I think that maybe she plays this a little bit cooler is because she's recognizing this is a thing I once wanted.
Yeah.
How foolish of me. Like, that was such a small potatoes thing. Mm-hmm. I've got a bigger mission now. Let's continue with that. And so she doesn't quite allow herself to feel the things that she might have felt in season one, but I'm with you. It was I think supposed to be a bigger moment, and the music was telling me it was bigger. I do like the choice not to put any dialogue in here. Mm-hmm. I don't think it needed it. I think it might have just needed a little bit more expressive acting.
I thought there was also some nice character moments where, like on the boat ride over, like Missandei and Tyrion, they're all just firmly fixed on Dragonstone, but like Varys
like kept stealing glances at the queen. Like he's still doing some mental arithmetic and kind of sizing her up. And
yeah,
I thought that was a subtle little character moment. And again, on first play, I thought it worked well enough. Let me ask you this. I can't remember if I saw this in feedback, which in case I'll eventually get to credit, or if this is something on Reddit someone was pondering. But what if they put this scene up front, and then we got the Arya scene, maybe the Arya scene where she closes out the phrase at the end of the episode? Because if this is the cold open and you get the "Shall we begin?" and then smash cut the Game of Thrones theme, like that would be kind of badass, wouldn't it?
Yeah. Yeah, I can't deny that.
Because it's like almost like she's presiding over the Game of Thrones Olympics, and this is the opening ceremony.
Right.
Having it at the end where it's a "Shall we begin?" smash to black. That's such a great moment, and it just like, because I was completely unprepared for it, because I thought we were like 30 minutes into the episode. I'm like, what the hell? Was this like a 43? No, it's a full hour. Wow.
Yeah.
So like, that's the other thing is like, people that say this is a plotting episode, I cannot agree with, because I was shocked when it came to the end. I thought it was much shorter than it was.
Yeah, me too.
So I don't know. I think it's kind of fun to kind of backseat show run, especially since in the behind the scenes, they mentioned that the Arya scene was not going to be the season opener, but the David's performance of Walder Frey was so good that they wanted to showcase it. Hmm. So I don't know. It's always fun to think of like, what if?
Yeah. Well, I got a question for you.
Yes.
Which throne do you like more, the Iron Throne or the throne here at Dragonstone?
The Dragonstone throne is pretty aesthetically pleasing.
Really cool.
The other thing is, I remember thinking the Iron Throne is really badass, and the concept that this Aegon the Conqueror took all the swords from the former lords and ladies and kings of the Seven Kingdoms and welded them into his own fucking throne.
Uh-huh.
But I've seen since, like, I think it's The World of Ice and Fire has a depiction of how George sees the Iron, and it's just so much cooler and more gothic and badass.
Huh.
That now every time I see, and I've sat on a replica, like a resin replica of the, and it's kind of underwhelming. Like this Dragonstone affair is really cool looking. And
yeah, I think the Dragonstone one conveys more power to me.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. Like you can see Aegon the Conqueror sitting on that and brooding.
Yeah,
like Conan at the end of the first movie, the Iron Throne. Like I don't, and maybe it's also that I've seen fucking Joffrey sit on that thing. I've seen Tommen,
yeah.
And it's almost like, how cool is it?
Right.
It's like if I was in, you know, I was waiting for my picture with the Iron Throne, and like a 3-year-old girl was sitting on top of it, and then I'm like, okay, how cool is this? How cool is this picture really going to be? Right beside on Facebook, beside mine, there's going to be a 3-year-old in a Pokemon dress in it. Like, I'm fooling myself.
Okay. I think the Dragonstone throne actually looks a little bit cooler.
Can we just call it Dragon Throne?
Dragon Throne, yeah.
All right.
And that's it. That's the end of the episode.
We're about 10 weeks out from House of the Dragon Season 2, and it's time to prepare for war.
Which in our case means, well, watching a lot of Hot D and reading a lot of Fire and Blood.
Each week between now and June 16th, Maester Anthony and his co-host Steve are hosting a watch of each episode of Hot D Season 1. And then me and Jim are going to host a discussion of the differences between the events on that episode and how they're recounted in George R. R. Martin's historical tome, Fire and Blood.
That's right, I've resorted to reading dragon books. God help us all. We'll see if my fresh eyes add any new insights or predictions into Season 2.
Arm yourselves with all the lore you can for the battles ahead. House of the Dragon returns June 16th, but we've got you covered until then.
Check out all of our upcoming Hot D coverage on the Hot D feed or on Bald Move Pulp, available wherever you listen to podcasts. FX is adapting James Clavell's best-selling novel, Shogun, into a 10-part miniseries this spring. Set in the shogunate period of Japan at the turn of the 15th century, Shogun depicts the rise of a feudal lord to Shogun, as seen through the eyes of a shipwrecked English sailor. It's loosely based on the real-life exploits of William Adams and Tokugawa Ieyasu.
Shogun has already been successfully adapted back in 1980 with a widely acclaimed miniseries starring Richard Chamberlain. Featuring intricate plots, political scheming, complex characters, and thrilling action.
This time, husband and wife team Justin Marks and Rachel Kondo try to recapture the successes of the novel and early adaptations while increasing the levels of historical and cultural accuracy that are often perceived as flaws of this and similar works.
Starring Hiroyuki Sanada from The Last Samurai, Mortal Kombat, and John Wick 4, with Cosmo Jarvis of Peaky Blinders, Raised by Wolves, etc., joining the truly massive cast required to bring this complex world to life. Join Aaron and I each week as we deep dive into each episode, uncovering the mysteries, the intrigue, and the glory of Shogun.
Shogun premieres on FX Hulu Tuesday, February 27th, with a two-part debut. Our podcast will release each Thursday thereafter. Get our Shogun coverage by searching for Bald Move Prestige in your favorite podcast app. Hey, it's time for another season of Why is Mr. Feeny a Car? The premise is simple. A Gen Xer and a millennial watch old 80s action TV to see what still works and what doesn't. In previous seasons, we've done podcasts for Knight Rider, Airwolf, MacGyver, A-Team, and more. However, this year we're doing a very special season of Feeny. We're going back and reviewing the very special episodes of 80s and 90s sitcoms. Come cringe along with us as Hollywood tries to warn our families of the dangers of underage smoking, drug abuse, alcoholism, eating disorders, and much more. We start out with the episode of Boy Meets World where a high school kid gets sucked into a cult. Worlds collide as the Mr. Feeny finally makes an appearance on Why is Mr. Feeny a Car? Join me and my buddy Jay each week for episodes full of nostalgia and secondhand embarrassment. And don't worry, a very special isn't your speed. We've also got some all-time classic Knight Rider episodes to close the season with. Find Why is Mr. Feeny a Car each Wednesday on Bald Move Pulp, starting April 3rd.
We got a couple sponsors this week. First up is Bald Move itself, club.baldmove.com. You can join up right now. Game of Thrones fans can get a discount, 25% off their yearly subscription rate if they go to club.baldmove.com and use the promo code GOT2017, GOT2017 during checkout. You'll get 25% off. It's our little special to you, and that sale goes from now until July 31st. So you still got a little bit of time to take advantage of it. If you go to the club page, there is like a breakdown of all the benefits you get, like ad-free feeds, VIP forum access, all the different bonus audio content and visual content you get. But it does support Bald Move. And you can also, just to further entice you, because that's where we're all about seduction here at Bald Move, we are embedding a little clip from our Lunch with Jim and Aaron, which is our weekly general interest podcast where we did a little bit of talking about my experience watching season two of Twin Peaks and being intrigued by a cross-dressing David Duchovny. That is at the end of the podcast for people to want to stay past the feedback and get a free preview of that. This podcast is also sponsored by Casper Mattresses at Casper.com. Casper Mattresses are obsessively engineered at a shockingly fair price. It combines supportive memory foams to create an award-winning sleep service with just the right sink and just the right bounce. With over 20,000 reviews and an average 4.8 stars, it's quickly becoming the internet's favorite mattress. And here's the only review you need. Aaron Hubbard has slept on this mattress for the last 3 years now?
Yeah, it's been a while.
We were one of the early adopters of Casper. Casper's been sponsoring with us a long time, and I was immediately impressed. And I had a perfectly comfortable, it was like a three-year-old at the prime of its life, conventional mattress that I bought from a reputable brick-and-mortar store. And it was a great experience. I love it. I can vouch for all these things they said. The fact that the one nice thing is they ship it to your house. And do you remember when Varys brought that warlock over and he was in a little wooden crate? Imagine, like, instead of a full-size human, he just, like, stuffed Varys in there, and he had a proportionately sized crate. Uh-huh. Like, maybe 3 foot tall by 2 by 2. That's what a king-size mattress comes in. And you just kind of, like, you know, open this packaging and it just explodes into a full-size, king-size mattress. It's so much easier if you're in an apartment.
Yeah, I've seen the box and I thought, I probably couldn't fit in that box. And
no.
Yet the mattress explodes out. And
that's the magic of foam.
Turns into something I can sleep on comfortably.
It does. And it is awesome.
You know, I was actually really shocked by the price. I was laying in bed on my non-Casper mattress because I haven't had the opportunity to get one yet. Or the need, really. I bought a pretty new mattress just before they started advertising with us.
So to me, I see. That's the trap they got you in.
But
the
here's
new
the
mattress
thing.
Trap.
But then they got me back because I was laying in bed. I was browsing. I went to their website. I looked at their shocking price and I shit my mattress. I shit the bed.
now I need
a new mattress. So.
You know how shocked you were when Ned got beheaded? You know how shocked you were when you first saw or read what? That's nothing compared to how shocked you will be when you go to Casper.com and see their mattress prices. They offer free shipping and returns to the U.S. and Canada. Try going to your favorite brick-and-mortar mattress store. Say, hey, I want to take this home for 100 nights, sleep on it, sweat on it, go to the website and shit all over it again because you're shocked by the prices all over again. They'll laugh in your face. They'll be like, you take it, it's yours. Casper will come and pick up the mattress for you, give you all your money back, up to 100 days. If you can't decide if a mattress is comfortable after 100 days, then what's going on?
Yeah.
It's also designed, developed, and assembled in the United States of America, which is pretty awesome. You can get $50 towards any mattress purchase by visiting www.casper.com/GOT and using GOT at checkout. Terms and conditions apply. Smash cut the feedback.
Okay.
We have a bunch of it. Of course, you can send this to GameOfThrones@baldmove.com. I want to open up with something. I think that I'm going to roll with a kind of no predictions rule. And I say that because since early this year, there has been a leak of essentially every major plot point of this season.
Yeah.
And I'm only about 10% spoiled on that stuff. Like most of the Watchers on the Wall people that we were talking to at the Con of Thrones, they were all hep to this. But I'm seeing some people, and this happens every fucking time you get leaked spoilers. I've seen some people package up some of that knowledge as shots in the dark. Mm-hmm. And the thing is since I'm not spoiled, I cannot separate that from people that I actually have unusually. And I'm just like, I don't really like predictions that much because, first of all, I get like 1,000 different variations a week. Mm-hmm. And it's like, I don't like them. So I'm just like, okay, well, I guess this is interesting. It's now that I got an excuse that this stuff is all spoiled and people can just look it up and regurgitate that stuff and get all the internet points, I'm not considering predictions.
And like, from the other side of it, like if you did go and you read all the spoilers and you knew what was spoilers and you chose not to read those, now we're only reading wrong predictions,
right?
And speculating on things we know aren't going to happen.
Yeah,
what the hell?
It's dumb. And I know that a lot of people do like predictions, and there's a fine line between like theory crafting, which I think is a subtle distinction between predictions and like I have a theory that this points to this, and you know I'm the ultimate arbiter of what that is and isn't, unfortunately. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I'm just going to shut. I'm not going to consider predictions on air because it all you got to do is search for season 7 Game of Thrones leak, and you can make 100% successful predictions. So
to be clear, other than our own predictions, because
I can guarantee. Now I will not read any gems because I cannot guarantee his purity, and he's the kind of guy that would do something like that.
I'm 100% unsullied on the new season.
Yeah. But
other than trailers,
I got like 3/4 through my note, and I just start. Wait a second, that sounds familiar. And I looked it up, and it's like someone had just bald face passed off a spoiler as prediction. I'm like, God damn
it, bullshit. Yeah.
So there you go. Caitlin T starting us off. The show has a consistent pattern of kings dying each season. Season 1, Robert; 2, Renly; 3, Rob; 4, Joffrey; 5, Stannis; 6, Tommen. Did you realize that?
I didn't. But
I hadn't
either.
Cool. Yeah. You could, like, when you get the Blu-ray supercut, you could just have the kings on the spine. Following this pattern, if there was a king's death in season 7, I think that means we're left with A, Cersei, which I think is doubtful this season; B, Dany, also doubtful this season; C, it says Job, but it's actually
Job. Character from the books.
Yes.
For all you show watchers only.
Yeah, the Bible. Yeah. Job.
That book.
John, who has really thick plot armor right now, or D, Euron. But there hasn't been enough character development on Euron to make his death as meaningful as the others.
Sure.
Do you think with the pace of this season they can make us really care if Euron dies, or is there another king that you think is more likely?
Man, they're never going to make me care about Euron. Euron is there as an opportunity for Cersei to service other characters.
Greyjoy come lately.
Yeah.
I never liked the Greyjoys. I was surprised when they got resurrected as a plot, which means, to my chagrin, they're important to the end game. And here's the other thing. Do the Double Ds consider, is this a true Season 7, Season 8 situation, or do they see this as Season 7A, Season 7B, much right. like the end of like game or Breaking Bad was?
Yeah.
Because, I don't know. I guess, I don't know. I think Cersei's likely to die this season, to be honest.
I do too, yeah.
And also you got the situation where some of these people could die and then be reborn. Mm-hmm. Either as a white or as a, and then like you could have your cake and eat it too. So I don't know. Like I guess I would go with Cersei or Dany if I was had to make a prediction. Like Dany, imagine Dany dying this season. It's such a shocker. Or Jon for that
would.
Matter.
Yeah, either of them, honestly. What about Alaria?
She's not a queen.
She not
or
a queen?
King.
No,
she's just a bastard.
What is the leader of Dorne? Called
princess, I suppose, but she's princess, not of okay. House Martell. She was never married
right,
to
right. But Oberyn. Somebody's got to take over. There's a power vacuum. I don't know who did it.
Yeah,
but probably Ilaria, if I had to guess.
Yeah, no, I think yeah. that's like they.
But she, yeah, she'd
they,
be a
they took
princess,
over by.
I guess.
Yeah, would she style herself as a princess? And she.
I don't know.
I don't know. I don't know what they call that too. But either way, they're not. They're not a king. Like even back in the days where they had the princedom or the principality, they weren't
right.
kings. So. Kathleen M., I'm still listening to the final podcast before the season. You just went over the reasons why it might be important that Jon is Targaryen. And I have another one, is that almost all dragon riders have had to have dragon blood to ride a dragon. Don't you think Jon mm-hmm. will be a third head of the dragon along with Tyrion and Dany? Problem with Tyrion isn't a Targaryen either.
Yeah.
You also have like, and then the other thing is, I don't think there's any show evidence that they have conclusively said you have to be a Targaryen to ride a dragon. And there's some
yeah.
questionable and contradictory information in the Apocrypha of the books. Like if you go back, there was the Princess and the Queen from the Dangerous Women anthology. It's one of the Duncan Eggs series where. There was this like open call to these dragon seeds to try because they were short on dragon riders. It's like come one, come all, try to ride a dragon, and they were looking for like Targaryen bastards or like third mm-hmm. and fourth sons. But I believe a few non-Targaryen civilians showed up and tried their hand, and at least two were successful. So
let me ask you this: what happens when you're not successful at riding a dragon?
You get burnt and eaten.
Do you?
Yeah.
So it's a thing where like
Ask
you
Quentin
can't
Martell.
Even get on and try it.
Oh.
It's just like you get close and you're
yeah.
But what if like 40 non-dragon riders rush a dragon?
Rush a dragon?
Yeah. Like he can only eat so many, right? Then he gets full.
Yeah.
I imagine one could get on its back. Then
yeah, there's another.
Do
so
they just slide right off?
There's yet another story where about 100 commoners took on a dragon in the Dragon Dome.
Dragon Dome.
Yeah.
Wait.
Tina Turner was there.
Yeah, stop right there.
Mel
what is
Gibson
the Dragon
was there.
Dome?
They actually refer to it in this episode where the Lannister kids are like, yeah, I wanted to see King's Landing. Go see the Sept of Baelor and the Dragon Dome. That's where the Targaryens, they had this giant domed enclosure to house their dragons.
Like the Colosseum, except
yeah.
with a roof?
Yeah, and some people say that was the doom of the dragons
shit.
Because they became stunted and they couldn't free range and they got shitty and all that. But like 100 commoners armed with like pitchforks and torches were able to kill a dragon that was confined. So, you know, they're not unkillable.
Yeah, for sure.
You know, it's their ability is they're very tough. They can breathe fire and they fly. And mm-hmm. there's not the, you know, that's a pretty good advantage to have in a pre aircraft era.
Yeah, I'd say.
All right. So like I said, it's inconclusive. We'll have to see. Back in five, by my count, is mentioned 3 times that the wall stood between Westeros and the White Walkers. Isn't that a clear sign that it's coming down? If not, I don't know what is. He's got a point. There was 3 different instances where people asserted that the wall is there, so who, you know, like, we don't have to worry about the White Walkers.
If John Mellencamp shows up next episode, it's over. he sings that song, right?
The wall come tumbling down.
Yeah.
Did he? I'm very weak.
I think it's John Mellencamp.
Classic rock.
Yeah.
Johnny Cougar.
Well, he doesn't go by that anymore.
I know.
He'd be offended if he heard that.
He would. Did you know that me and John Mellencamp are blood?
I actually did, yeah.
We're second cousins.
Yeah, a lot of weird stuff happened in Mooresville.
They did. He did. I saw him at a family reunion once. So I can call him Johnny Cougar. He said, okay when I was seven. Yeah, I really cooled down on the whole idea of Bran taking down the wall sometime between this season and last. Mm-hmm. And I'm still kind of off that bandwagon. They're not treating his crossing as like he went into the wall.
Yeah.
Like in any circumstance, can you imagine they cut the next and it's just like
it's crumbled.
Dolorous Ed standing in the rubble, like, well, right. This figures.
Uh-huh.
You know, I trusted the damn kid. Now the wall's like, I just don't see it. But I also see what Back in Five is saying. There's a lot of foreshadowing with people being very overconfident.
I think to me it's all about, you know, the potential magic barrier of the wall, Bran going through it, this mark destroying the magic barrier, and these giants taking down the wall. Like, literally beating their way through the wall.
Right.
I think they could do it.
Oh, yeah. That's the thing. Like, there's no question in my mind. No question in my mind they can't beat a hole through that gate.
Right.
Also, I also think that everyone has this idea that it was the mark that destroyed the protection in the tree. But what really happened was that was the locator. So they found the tree, and then the Night King with his sheer power.
Really?
Yeah, wasn't that it? Like he?
I don't know. But
yeah, I thought that allowed them to locate it, and then the Night's King, flanked by his flunkies, came up there and did something magical to like blow a hole through the barrier.
Yeah, I mean, it's clearly a tracking device. We've seen that.
So I don't know. Like I said, I don't think I'm positive that the wall falling is not going to be coupled to Bran, because that's just shitty storytelling. but if it falls, I don't know. Like I said, that's you got a solid point there, Backen.
Mm-hmm.
Travis M. from West Virginia. The Archmaester tells Samuel Tarly that the Citadel and its maesters are the world's memory. Do we think that Sam in some way writes the story that we know as A Song of Ice and Fire? We know that the Lord of the Rings is a big influence on George, and he wants a bittersweet ending to the story. That book ends with a return to home, but pains of war lingering as Samwise Gamgee writes in The Red Book, which becomes The Lord of the Rings. I know it won't literally be the same, but it's definitely an interesting possibility.
Yeah, we've discussed this before.
What do you think of an aged Sam closing out the series as he writes The Song of Ice and Fire?
I suppose. I feel like that's a bit of a cliche.
It's a cliche with one example, though. Like, can you have a trope
But I always feel like, you know, okay, literally writing, you know, a history of the story, but there have been all kinds of things that have been like, oh, and this is me telling you the story of that thing, sitting down with little Timmy by the fire and telling you the story, or the Princess Bride, like me reading in the book. Yeah. Like, it's been done to death, and I don't know that Martin or the Double D's want to go there.
Plus, some of these things are so distinctive that they're a trope. Like you can't have John getting bit by a spider and start climbing walls.
Uh-huh.
Like, it's not fair to say that's a trope, but it's such a distinctive thing that people will cry foul. Mm-hmm. It's an interesting idea, especially since you know it's Sam. They're both Sams, right?
Yeah.
But I think we've made a good, compelling case about why he might not exactly follow down the path of JRR.
But you're not wrong that Martin is partially inspired by Tolkien. So
sure. I mean, everyone that's picked up a pen and written fantasy has been inspired by Tolkien.
But he's like specifically talked about how he was inspired and what he wanted to do differently.
The things that he wanted. Yeah. You're right.
So,
Kristen P. I've been shipping this theory for a while now, and everyone seems to brush it off. But I want to see what you thought of it. Sansa had such a brush of bad luck when it comes to relationships. It seems that she could use some real lovin' in her life.
Oh boy,
who do we know that can give her that? Oh yeah, our favorite, talented in all the right ways, Squire Sir Podrick.
Oh,
whenever I bring it up, people say no, he's not enough born for her. But don't we think that she might be past that now? After being engaged to Prince Joffrey, married to Lord Ramsay, and don't forget Tyrion. Neither of which brought her sunshine and rainbows. Might she realize that there could be more to a relationship than someone's title and position?
I like it. I can see them together.
Do you? Because the thing is, like, other than Pod the Rod, like, Pod is just very dull. Now,
less so as of late.
Him being tootled under Brienne is interesting, because Brienne's the closest thing we got to a true knight of Westeros. That's always been Sansa's love affair. She always wanted to find the Dorian to her Jonquil or whatever. I probably got that mispronounced and backwards, but whatever. You know, she's always wanted to have this courtly, beautiful, true knight.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess Pod is probably, like, if he continues learning from Brienne, gets a little bit more backbone and a little bit more polish, a little bit more worldliness. But I just feel like that Sansa seems a lot smarter and more astute than her than him at this point. So
for sure.
I just don't think like you take Pod's knighthood and Tyrion's wittiness, and maybe you'd have something. But maybe that she takes two husbands.
What about
Tristan? Tyrion to amuse her and Pod to do the other things.
Yeah.
What do you
go
say?
Go for it. What about Tristan? Is that his name? Tristan? Tristan?
Didn't he die?
I think he might have died.
Yeah.
I'm not sure. He was on a boat writing a letter or something. That was the last I remember him. But...
Oh, no, for sure. For sure.
Yeah.
Yeah, he got killed at the... That was one of the...
Oh, the sand snakes killed him.
Yeah.
Stabbed him through his face.
That didn't happen.
Nope.
And then also, like, before anyone says, we don't like the John and Sansa pairing at this podcast.
No, not really.
Little too gross.
Yeah, it's cousins. It's not, you know, brother-sister, but
right.
Still.
Right. Mm. Yeah. Yeah, little gross. And I get it. They're not really brother and sister, but they raised that. And I think that's the important thing.
Sure. Yeah.
All right. Annie H. Who else was surprised about seeing a celeb cameo in GOT? Never really thought I'd see the day. Even though his character said it was a new song, which presumably means he made it up, I can't help but think there must be something to this. I mean, Hands of Gold immediately brings Jaime to mind. I'm really intrigued by that line around the chain and the keep. Any thoughts from y'all on this? Aaron, does it make... you think of anything from your vast Game of Thrones cache of knowledge? Whew, I'm blushing.
Like the words of the song he's singing?
Yeah, so this is actually a song from the book. And this is old news. In the second book, there's this singer who tried to blackmail Tyrion because he became aware of Tyrion's tryst with Shae. His name was Simeon Silvertongue. And he sung this Hands of Gold as a reference to Tyrion's rank of hand, because in the book, not only did he have the gold pin of the hand, but he also wears this chain of office, which is an interlocking golden hands. Like the chains are all hands holding on to each other. And he also uses that necklace to strangle Shae, in the climactic point of the book.
Nice.
So this Hands of Gold was this song that the singer used to subtly try to blackmail Tyrion. Tyrion had Bronn kill him, and then they made stew out of him that they served out at Fleabottom.
Oh, Jesus.
So...
Wait, why?
Because Tyrion's not going to be blackmailed by some fucking singer.
Yeah, but he doesn't have to feed human bits to the Fleabottom people.
But he also doesn't want a body being discovered in the city.
I feel like that's a cruel joke on the Fleabottomers.
Tyrion's not a fucking cuddly guy, man.
Not in the books, anyway, I guess.
He can be pretty fucking... Well, he strangled his lover and murdered his father.
I feel like those were justifiable. Yeah.
All right, Raylan.
Yeah.
But that's the background. I felt like that was just a little bit of a goose to book readers, because, number one, it's a way to get another one of these, like, Baron and Maiden Fair type things. Anything besides Baron and Maiden Fair and fucking Reigns of Castamere... Also, it's a little hint to the fact that, like, if the Lannister soldiers are singing this, it's kind of a mockery of Tyrion, so it's maybe a repudiation of the Lannister. There's a lot going on there, is what I'm saying.
Cool.
But that's the only thing I can bring to it. Alan P., I was listening to your feedback preview podcast and had a comment about the part of Sansa figuring out that Littlefinger is behind the killing of her father. Wasn't the Hound in the throne room when Littlefinger took Ned prisoner? The Hound is heading north where he could potentially meet up with Jon and Sansa. When he arrives, wouldn't he scream, "What? Why the fuck is Littlefinger here? He killed your father." Or am I remembering the series of events wrong? You're not, sir. The Hound was in the throne room. So that is a excellent... Between that and the picture of the sketch of the dagger, there's two different ways that Littlefinger could get hitched up here.
Yeah. Interesting.
Yeah. He'd say fook, though. He wouldn't say fuck. Caitlin... Do you think Sam knows Jorah's at Old Town? Is that a prison or what? Why does his grayscale look black burnt instead of the gray stone look like season 5 showed us?
Does Sam even know Jorah?
I don't think so.
No.
Now, he would definitely recognize his life. If he finds out that it's a Mormon, he would definitely... I wonder if that's going to be a way for them to make conversation.
Oh, boy.
As far as the look, I mean, I can't really comment much on that without getting into spoiler territory. I could make the observation that maybe that's supposed to be what it looks like when it's pustulant, because, again, he's shut up there. Looks like he's shitting on the floor and rolling around in it, and there's no light. I mean...
Yeah, it's a bad scene.
It just looks like he needs some Valtrex. He's got full body herpes. Chelsea T. I found a scene with the Hound looking into the fire. I lost my place. I found a scene with the Hound looking into the fire and seeing the future very odd. I half expected his vision to be a joke that ends with him turning to Beric and calling him a cunt. Can we get a count of how many times he said that word this episode? Yeah, he's a prolific cunter.
Mm-hmm.
anyways, Vision seeming that is a good point. Like, I didn't see this, but I got a lot of people wrote in and said that they thought that he was just taking him for a ride because it's so surprising the Hound could just step up and look him through the fire, you know?
Yeah.
Anyway, his vision being seemingly legit makes me think that his part in the story is way more important than just a Clegane Bowl level. What are you guys' thoughts on him potentially being the prince that was promised? Thoros has taken a liking to him. I'm really intrigued with him being way more important than we all thought.
Oh, boy.
Woo. Real dark horse candidate.
Yeah. Yeah, I don't think I've ever heard of that theory before.
Real dark horse candidate. The problem is if you look at the theories about the prince, or the actual prophecies about the prince's promise and descriptions, which some of them are in the show, some are in the books, it doesn't seem like the Hound really fits any of them. So that would be, I guess, my concern with the whole thing. Do you have any other comments?
No.
Moving on, Stephen J. In the instant cast, you guys discussed Dany walking by the throne of Dragonstone as possible evidence for Westerosi democracy. It's her end game. My take on that scene was that she was walking by the throne because it's not her end goal, which is the Iron Throne. I think we talked about this.
Well, sure.
Little slice of dry pie there, Stephen. Sorry about that. Wash it down in some Arbor Gold. Stephen S., you both were discussing the failure of House Lannister to defend Dragonstone. I was thinking it was some of their better strategy. A, we know Ned put it under siege, so it can't support itself food-wise, and Dany has a very large army to feed. 2, it limits the Dothraki, as they are, of course, heavy cavalry. 2, in the open sea battle, the dragons would be decisive. However, in Blackwater Bay fight, Cersei could attempt another fireship strategy against the concentrated fleet. It seems they let her take the worst possible place for her, as opposed to somewhere like the Reach or Dorne. So, do you think that we could see this as a tactical decision by Cersei and Jaime to allow her to take Dragonstone?
No, I think they were unprepared.
Yeah, because I don't want to grant Cersei as any kind of strategic genius about anything.
Yeah, and I don't think Jaime was back in time to do anything about it. They had just fought this battle at River Run, right? So I think he's just arriving home about the same time that Dany is taking Dragonstone.
Yeah.
So, no, I think it's an oversight. But I mean, those are fair points about Dragonstone.
Indeed.
All true things, I suppose.
Because that's the way. It's like, if you want to see it that way, then there's nothing wrong from you headcanoning in that.
Yeah.
And those are all good points. Tom H., had a quick thought based of your preview podcast and the instant take. Why do you say that Jaime or the Hound have to die? You mentioned they have committed atrocities and atrocious acts in the past, but their good deeds since don't make up for them, and they have to die still. But why? I think this is because we're assigning our 21st century morals to fictitional characters who live in a medieval time where, in a non-fantasy history, the bad guys often live happily ever after. In real human history, Cersei might have gone on to live her whole life happily. I mean, Stalin is arguably the worst killer in history, arguably worse than even Hitler, and was died of natural causes after killing tens of millions of his own people.
Yeah, I think it has something to do with the way that Martin writes, right? And his discussions of karmic consequence.
I think it's funny when people are like, oh, you're assigning 21st century. Well, you know who's writing this? A fairly liberal 21st century guy.
Right.
I mean, if you look at his blogs and his writings, like, you know, he's got a certain worldview, and you would expect that worldview to eventually be reflected in his stories. Now, that's a big question we're always asking ourselves. What is Martin playing at? Mm-hmm. Is he going to continue to subvert tropes and happy endings to the bitter end? I've heard the ending described and as George originally envisioned it as bittersweet, which means it's not going to be saccharine, but it's also not going to be unrelentingly oppressive. So that's the thing, like that, and I also started to think of like how many bad guys in this show have gotten away scot-free. Sure, good people have died for no reason, but I can't think of a single evil character who has not come to a bad end.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you still got the ones that are still playing the game, but like, do people honestly think Cersei's making it out? Do people think Euron's going to make it out? Like,
right.
I don't.
I mean, when we say, you know, they have to die or they have to pay these consequences, we're talking loosely. We're using those terms loosely about a potential narrative payoff,
exactly.
Right? Like the structures of storytelling are what we're talking about. And
right.
I think when we say, oh, this character has to die because of what they've done in the past, it's not satisfying if you don't do that,
right.
In a lot of cases. And maybe George Martin doesn't want to write a satisfying story. He wants to write what he views as a realistic story, which, you know, maybe leaves a couple dragons out of it. But my point is, like, when we talk about this, we're talking about narrative stuff. Right. Not necessarily like, oh, it has to be this way because, you know, that's how I feel about it or anything. It's like, this is just what makes a satisfying story.
I thought I had
And he could always go the other way, but we're talking about, like, what would make it satisfying.
Right. And we don't know the answer to that, but it's just, you know, I think it's a fair point to ponder. I thought I had another book in where someone had a defense of Jamie. I thought I put these together as, you know, as a narrative device myself, and hopefully I'll get to that. But
and you never know when enough is enough as far as payment for your previous sins.
Exactly.
Right? So, like, when we say, oh, maybe Jamie's already paid for his sins with his hand, you know, or the hound with his face, and, you know, he prepaid.
Right, yeah.
That kind of stuff. You just don't know.
Yeah.
How far does George want to go with that?
And we also, their stories are still being told. Like, Jamie could have a moment where he sins again for, like, you know, like, he decides he at the end of the, he can't go against Cersei because it's a sister and he's loved her and every possible way he can love a sister for since they popped out of the womb. You know, he could be a tragic figure that way, to where he just betrays everything he stood for because of the love for his woman. I don't know. We'll see. What is Martin playing at? No one knows. I don't know if Martin knows these days. Ben M., I've been thinking about Daenerys breaking the wheel theory. What if she sets up a parliamentary government and then the last scene she kills Drogon herself, putting an end to the rule of her house? My God, is Dany going to murder her own children to ensure a democratic rule over Westeros?
That seems that seems a little extreme.
Right.
But also, I don't dislike it.
I mean, dragons would be a tool for tyranny. Like, anything that anything that's an unbeatable weapon for good in the wrong hands is an unbeatable weapon for evil.
Right.
So it stands to reason, if she wanted to really make sure Westeros was going to be in the hands of the people, that she would not have one side having nuclear weapons and the others literally sticks and stones.
Yeah.
On the other hand, whew, that would be a scene. That would be a scene. So
doesn't require subtlety, so I think she could pull it off.
It does. No, like, she could use her powerful and mildly bummed out face.
Right.
And maybe set her clothes on fire and you'd have something. So there you go. Luke KD, my question, are we really all cool with Arya Stark killing an entire family and wiping out a whole house in the process?
Yep.
We are.
It's
next
the phrase.
Email.
Yes,
next
we are.
Email. I'll let you close out your argument. We know it's only Walder Frey who Arya initially named on her kill list. Yes, there's blood on their hands too, but no more so than the family members of the Umbers and the Karstarks, who Jon Snow shows mercy to in the very same episode. Let's not forget that Robert Baratheon pardoned all the loyalists following his rebellion.
The difference being, they all betrayed and murdered her family.
And also, we're seeing a little subtle transformation in Arya here. Like, this scene with the Lannisters might be her starting to get more of an even keel as far as her humanity. But also, like, I'm not going to feel sorry for the Freys. I mean, I felt like they did enough to show, A, these were all Freys with an active hand in murdering the entire Stark household and all their loyal bannermen in the most cowardly, craven, more disrespecting way that you can in Westeros. And they also showed Arya sparing the non-combatants.
Right.
So she's not just, like, totally fucking evil. But, I mean, but you can be disturbed by that.
Yeah.
Like, that's been Arya's kind of shtick the whole time. Like, we're rooting for this little traumatized girl to kill people real good. That's uncomfortable, and that's an interesting dramatic possibility to play with. So, moving on, Jeremiah T. This is the negative email. I've been majorly, but not a. I mean, I'd say it's minority, but not like a tiny minority. I've been majorly hyped up so that anything short of the Battle of the Hardhome Blackwater Bastards would have felt like a disappointment.
Yep.
But I have to give this episode a middling to failing grade. It started strongish with the opposite or poisoning of the Freys, I guess, but the scene had none of the power of last year's close shave, and the haha faceless man mask peel is officially played out. I cannot see it anymore. It's such a low rent move. I think we're in broad agreement about the latter point.
Yeah, I don't want to see that too many times.
They need to be very careful how much they play the faceless man stuff from here on out. From there, it moved into a lot of talking.
What if Arya's just Ed Sheeran for the rest of the season?
I like it. I'll allow it. And then she rips off the mask and it's fucking Katy Perry. or Lady Gaga? Which would be more shocking?
Why not do them both? How many masks does she wear?
She's the dude from Die Antwoord.
How pissed off would the fans be?
I mean, that's the thing. Like, boy, you get the wrong kind of troll personality, and you've taken George's legacy from him. You could really do some goddamn damage. You could start probably a shooting war if you wanted to. From there is a lot of talky talk. I had expectations that Jamie and Cersei's first interaction on camera would be a blow up, but how could it not be? Instead, we get a very tame interaction with Jamie whining that they haven't even talked about Tommen. Giving Jamie's background as the guy who saved King's Landing from wildfire at the cost of his reputation, I expected a little more from him. I think I already defended that viewpoint, so that's the other side of the coin. Mm-hmm. Speaking of Euron, where to start? First question, do you shop at New Rockstar's House of Leather? But most importantly, where'd you get all those ships? It hasn't been a year.
You built them.
Cersei's hair is still short, and I don't believe she's going to that look on purpose. How did the relatively unpopulated, unforested Iron Islands come up with the thousands of ships in such a short time? Are they renting? Then Euron's preening performance in front of the throne, the whole thing was a hot mess. The rest is either workmanlike or forgettable.
Huh. Yeah, I agree with some points of that. I disagree strongly with others.
And we talked in the preview podcast, like, you got to overlook time, like the jetpacking and all that. But this is logistically indefensible.
Sure.
There's no fucking way this guy got all of his ship stolen.
Uh-huh.
And he comes rolling up with a fleet that he purported to have be 1,000 ships in a matter of weeks. There's no fucking way.
No way. And we said that when Yara stole all the ships.
And unlike other times, they carefully established a timeline here because Walder Frey, as Arya said, I know it's rare for me to feast you 2 fortnights in a row. So presumably 2 weeks have elapsed since the previous episode.
Uh-huh.
And maybe a couple more. Not long enough to build 1,000 fucking warships of this size and complexity. It's ridiculous. My hope is that it's a bluff, that Euron doesn't have these many ships. He's counting on getting something that will so impress Cersei that she'll overlook that. And because if they expect us to believe 1,000 ships get made, I mean,
he has a lot of ships, not 1,000, I don't think, that we saw, but 100?
Unless 600 of them are Gendry class rowboats, I'm not buying it.
And I don't think you could build one ship in 2 weeks.
No.
With the technology they have.
Yeah. I'm surprised I don't know how long it would take to build a wooden ship.
It would take a long time.
Yeah, it seems like it was months, if not years, to do a single one.
That would be my guess, too. And then you got to think, okay, they sailed it to King's Landing.
Which that's not. I mean, that alone would probably take a week or two to sail around from the Iron Islands all the way around to the... Because it's on the opposite coast.
So they effectively had zero time.
Right.
To build any ships.
I mean, they're using the replicators from Star Trek. They got the Utopia Planitia shipyard just pushing buttons.
Yeah.
Some Rick and Morty shit happening. I'm consciously choosing to overlook it because if you're going to say this is bullshit and dumb and they're not even trying anymore, then the season's over before it even began for you. And that would be sad.
Yeah.
Daniel J., something that came up in your preview episode. Oh, sorry. These are the two bookmarked ones, bookended ones, and two Daniels. Daniel J is first. There's something that came up in your preview episode and again in your instant take of last night's episode that I'd be curious to hear you explain more. Aaron, a few times you discussed the potential fate of characters like the Hound and the Jaime in terms of the story arcs meeting a definition of justice. This surprised me since it was my understanding that Martin had tried to make his fictional universe as real as possible by removing an omniscient and justice-wielding god force. In other words, in the real world, the good and bad die alike. Sometimes people pay their sins, sometimes they don't, and so it goes in Martin's books. So there's part one. We largely talked about that already. Daniel N. says, I want to talk about Jamie. You talked about how you feel Jamie must have a helping of Martin's justice coming his way, and that it feels strange that he seems amicable with Cersei. First, I think he has taken his fair share of karmic payback already. In fact, it seems that his story has been loosely written to show how his punishment fits his crimes. His attempts to murder Bran has resulted in him losing all of his children. He proceeds to tear a family apart, starting when he attacks Ned, and now his own father is dead. Lancel betrays him, and he is now also dead. His uncle Kevin disowns him, and he is also now dead. And of course, his brother has now handed the queen to his enemy. He has used his fighting skills for selfish gain and lost his hand. You might even say that the Lannister family has not fared any better than the Starks, and perhaps even worse. I think Jamie's continued relationship with Cersei boils down to what you might call a sunk cost fallacy. Should he leave her? Absolutely. He probably even knows this on some level. However, he's murdered for his sister and fought wars for his family. He put all of his eggs in the Lannister basket. Where else could he go? What does he have to offer if he leaves the Lannister name? Certainly not his prowess with the sword. In the end, I think Jamie's choice is between having nothing to live for and still living for Cersei. What really got me about this email here of Daniel Inns is that it does seem like Jamie has paid a pretty high price for the shit that he's pulled in his life.
Yeah. I have a tendency to forget that these are Jamie's children as well.
Right, right.
And I think of them in prophecy terms, right, as they mean more to Cersei.
Right, they're like a scoreboard.
Right, but he has lost just as much, if not more, than Cersei at this point.
Right, and like he almost killed Bran while all of his children died.
Right.
He tried to extinguish the Starks and his own line has been snuffed out. Like, there is a little symmetry there that I'm not quite on the full, I think Jamie's fine and he's going to get off scot-free, but it seems like he's pretty on even footing with the Hound. The only way the Hound has a little bit more of a karmic bump is the Hound had no chance. He was born into a life of bullshit, whereas Jamie had everything going for him and, didn't make the best choices. But you could also make an argument that Jamie tried to do the right thing and was constantly being subverted by his father and his sister.
Yeah, and the thing I always come back to with Jamie is the killing of the Mad King, right?
Yeah.
And how that is such a defining moment in his life.
Right.
The problem I have with he and Cersei's relationship at this point is that she's done the same thing, and he doesn't seem to be calling her out for it.
Right.
Now, maybe Jaime's changed so much along the way or lost so much along the way that he's unwilling to do that now, but I guess I don't know. Like, personally, I'm not seeing it. I don't know why he would change his mind on that.
Right.
Especially when he's fighting for the realm in these conversations, right? Like, we need food. We need to hold up for the winter here. I feel like he's still fighting a little bit for the realm, whereas Cersei's all for Cersei.
And that's, like I said, that's consistent with his characters. I feel like if you read the books, you come away with the impression that Jaime wanted to be that true knight that, Sir Duncan the Tall and Sir Barristan the Bold. He wanted to be that shining example of the realm, and things just didn't work out that way because he loved his sister, and that's a love that can never be. And in a way that Cersei always seemed a little bit more malevolent, like Cersei tortured Tyrion as a baby. Mm-hmm. Of course, he killed his. Cersei had this obsession with this witch that had her do terrible things. Cersei never loved Jaime the way Jaime loved her, I don't think, because she was all too willing to leave Jaime for the fact that, I get to marry the king now. Mm-hmm. They're different in that way. So I don't know. Maybe there is room for his redemption. I'm a little bit more open to it than I was last week, thanks in large part to Daniel here. Henry, Arya / Walder Frey said, "This is the finest Arbor Gold," as the servants poured red wine. Literally unwatchable.
It wasn't white.
Yeah, it's supposed to be. I mean, seems like an unforced error. Like, come on. No one in the production knew that Arbor Gold is canonically a white
sound
wine.
The sound of it alone, Arbor Gold.
Yes.
Gold, to me, says a white wine.
It does. Like, you could say, like, well, maybe it's like gold, or, like a gold standard.
Right, like
and
premium.
Right, but, like, I still think that, and again, canonically, it's a white, so what the fuck? Literally unwatchable, I agree. In fact, we're not doing the podcast anymore. Everything's all canceled, done. I don't need the last 12. Josh F., back in season 1 and 2, Sansa literally went through the same thing as the Karstarks and Umber children are going through now. After Ned was arrested for treason, Sansa was brought into a room with Cersei and her council, and she said that she had traitor's blood. That bias against Sansa's traitor's blood continued through season 4. Now she's essentially doing the same thing against Umber and Karstark children.
She did learn a lot from Cersei.
See, that's the thing. Like, you're saying this as a negative, Josh, but I'm seeing this like that was incredibly effective. Like, not only did they shit completely on Sansa, but she had to be twice as loyal and twice as, like, I feel like that maybe the lesson she learned from there is, like, that's not a bad way to go. Hmm. Like, use someone's guilt and fear to get their compliance,
As opposed to appealing to their honor and loyalty, like Ned would.
Yeah.
I think there's a balance that you have to strike.
And I'm not saying she would go after them, but the people that have actually betrayed her house. Maybe that's not from her point of view. Maybe that's not a terrible thing.
Yeah.
So yeah, I don't. I just thought that was interesting. Connor A. in South Carolina, heard y'all's instant take, and you said you wouldn't be surprised if the next episode Ed Sheeran's Lannister crew were all strung up and gutted. I'm 99% sure that won't happen due to guest rights. In the episode, they offer Arya food, and she is hesitant in accepting because she knows that if she does, she'll be bound by the laws of guest right and not be able to kill them without violating that sacred bond. What do you think about that?
I mean, she doesn't seem like she wants to kill them. She seems like she's worried they're going to kill her.
Hmm.
And once the guest right thing happens, she's already kind of warmed up to them a little.
Why does she then say, I've come to kill the queen? Did she know that I was going to be passed off as a joke? Because it seems like that was at that point an open challenge to them.
You think so?
Yeah, I mean, what the hell?
I mean, I guess they have some duty to kill her at that point. I don't know.
If they take her seriously, right. She did nothing to betray that she was joking until they started laughing first. So,
yeah.
I mean, here's the thing. If she does gut this crew, it's going to tell us something decisive about her character.
Mm.
If she doesn't, then it's going to show that there is some vestigial code that she is not a hypocrite enough to get vengeance on the Freys for violating guest right and murdering her family, and she's not going to stoop to that level.
Yeah.
So... But the stakes are very clear. If she does, then it's going to tell us something very important about her character.
Yeah.
James S., if Jon agreed to Sansa and gave the ancestral homes of Umbers and the Karstarks to other loyal members, doesn't that set up Jon losing Winterfell if Dany conquers Westeros? As Tywin said, when enemies defy you, you must serve them steel and fire. When they fall to their knees, however, you must help them back to their feet. Elsewise, no man will ever bend the knee to you. I guess I don't want to see what this has to do with Jon fighting a war against the conquest of Dany. Because if she conquers him, then it's not like Jon swore an oath of allegiance to her.
Right.
Like, he was rebelling against this bullshit kingdom, which even Dany would probably see. And he was made the rightful king in the north. And he took his chances and he lost a dragon. So is she going to punish him for that? It's like, it's not like he broke an oath. And that's not what Aegon did. So,
I honestly don't see a war between Jon and Dany ever breaking out here. I don't think that's a battle they need to fight.
I don't think it's something they need or should to fight. I just think it would be an interesting, dramatic possibility.
Yeah, I just don't think it's going to happen. We can speculate on it if you want to.
You're off the Mad Queen bandwagon for Dany?
I think so.
There's still room on the wagon. That wagon is not nearly capacity yet, Jim.
No, I realize that, and I'm not sure. I've got one foot dangling off. I'm ready to jump off at any moment.
Quinn B., not necessarily related to this episode, but something I'm not hearing anyone talk about. Are we ever going to see a dragon killed? Seeing dragons die is not something I want to see, but I think it needs to happen to add some complexity to the living versus walker plot. Otherwise, do we just assume Dany plows through any foe in her way? Just many questions here. Who would kill a dragon? How do you kill a dragon? Are they just even more intense version of giants in terms of health? Thinking of all the spears it took down to take one, would it be 50 times that for a dragon? Or is there some secret soft spot akin to the Death Star? Their scrot is completely unarmored and disproportionately large for flying speed.
Yeah,
they haven't shown it because it hasn't been a good angle, but my God, it's like two mammoths dangling between Drogon's legs. I'm aware the dragons are not we already talked about this a bit. It's a little bit of dry pie, but just to reiterate, dragons are not invincible in this world. They're canonically vulnerable to like those scorpion things, those like giant crossbows, those that killed them
or whatever they're called.
They're very susceptible to civil war.
Mm.
Like when you have a dance of dragon situations where like if there's some schism that would arise within Dany's forces where they would steal allegiance of dragons from her. And then, of course, you know, you can just overwhelm a dragon. Like, a dragon can fall through, you know, being littered with arrows or spears. Now, the older the dragon gets, the hotter the fire and the harder their scales. But there again, Dany's dragons are not exactly that old. So,
yeah.
It'd be interesting. I think you're right. I would be surprised if all three dragons survived to the end because Dany losing even one of those dragons would be a pretty huge opportunity for her to be bummed out and powerful.
Yeah, I think it adds
gives
a lot
room for Amelia the stretch.
It has a lot of dramatic possibilities, yeah. Killing a dragon. So I would be interested in seeing it.
Jasmine A. Just thought about this after seeing the giants as whites. Will one of these snatch a dragon out of the sky? We get our hearts broken again seeing Hodor as a zombie.
How low are these dragons going to fly?
They definitely didn't burn his body. Yeah, the
how
thing
high
is,
can a giant jump?
The
That's
giant's
the
like
other
three
question.
Times bigger than a four times bigger than a human. Like, did you see fucking the dragons?
Enormous calves, though.
Yeah.
Enormous quads and calves on those giants.
But they're still not going to be able to snatch a dragon out of the sky.
They can leap like you wouldn't believe.
Now, would I believe that, like, a dragon's arrow or crossbow could, like, a giant's crossbow or arrow or spear could do a lot of damage to it? Hell yeah.
Yeah.
But, yeah, I don't think they're going to be swatting them out of the skies like flies.
I feel like the dragon has committed a serious tactical error.
Yeah.
If they allow a giant to swat them out of the sky.
Sure. Do we think we'll see Hodor as a zombie?
Probably.
Yeah.
Super likely.
I mean, they showed the one little wildling woman that we kind of had a minor attachment in an episode to.
Uh-huh.
Why wouldn't he?
Yeah.
And it would be a real kick in the crotch, which makes me think it's definitely going to happen. A lot of people ask me if the giant, the one of the ice giants is 1-1. I don't think so, because 1-1 died in Winterfell, and the whites are all north.
I'm sure they burned him, right?
Yeah, you'd think. Is there that much lumber in Winterfell?
Well, I just mean I wouldn't want that thing coming back,
right.
And Jon knows. So
right. The other question is, some people said, well, maybe that was Bran seeing a future possibility of, like, you know, this was the army, but I don't know.
We've always seen Bran in his visions, right?
Have we? I'm trying to think of it. Even in early, when
haven't.
He was still a little boy, if there is any of those crow visions that didn't have him. And
maybe the one where he's kind of a wolf going into the caves, the tombs, whatever they're
right.
called, catacombs.
Yeah.
But recently, we've always seen him in his visions.
Yeah. Like I said, it could be, but it hasn't been established one way or another yet.
How about this?
Yeah.
So we know that Hodor went out holding the door, right?
Yes.
What if he's the one who takes down the door through the wall? What if he gets under there and lifts it up?
He'd be Odor then.
Right, he'd be...
Open the door.
Rodo.
What is that?
Rectador? Hodor backwards.
Oh.
Rodo. Hashtag Rodo. Start it up.
You're a fuss away from having a dragon shout, man.
Yeah. You're right.
Lauren H., can we talk about Edmure Tully? In the season 6 finale, Walder tells Jaime that Edmure is back in chains. I was hoping to see Arya find out her uncle was still in the dungeon below the Twins or River Run and go release him. With the Frey's dead, he could retake River Run and then boom, there's another ally for the Starks. An uncle meeting his badass niece for the first time and learning that she just killed the Frey's. A lot of potential for a great / interesting scene. You're right. I'm actually kind of surprised that, you know, if they can get to Edmure and solidify the Riverlands, that would be a nice feather for John's cap.
Yeah.
She also asks, what about Ghost? Do you think they're essentially just writing the wolf out of the show? He wasn't in last season after John was resurrected. He wasn't at the Battle of the Bastards and wasn't at Winterfell afterwards either. I know that the director said the only reason he wasn't in the Battle of the Bastards because they had to make a budget decision about animating 1-1 or the wolf, and they went with 1-1.
Yeah.
Now, why they couldn't fucking composite a giant white wolf laying at Rob's feet, or even just have a stuffed one, I don't know. I don't know. But I don't think they're gonna write that character out.
I think they're saving the budget.
Yeah, they would have a lot of people screaming about something like that. Phil and Indy, I found myself laughing at the idea of Ice King Coors Light commercial you mentioned in Instant Cast. That got me thinking about some other commercial tie-ins.
How about
one where Arya leads a group of protesters through the streets of King's Landing and hands the zombie mountain a Pepsi? Too soon, man. Too soon. Don't give Pepsi any ideas. Tom W., I'm curious to know how you think Grayscale is going to feature in the endgame. The fact that the showrunners have decided to keep this plot in the show makes me think that Grayscale will have some significant impact in the proceedings. Do you guys have any theories?
I really don't
you,
see
you
it.
Had, you used to have, like, grayscale equals immunity to dragon fire equals something. I don't know.
Yeah, that was the problem. So the
grayscale plus question mark equals profit, and it had a question mark. But
yeah, at this point, it seems too late to really do much with grayscale. I mean, aside from like the dragon glass to Danny to like
I mean, after this,
I don't know.
And like all the little hints that they've put to its you know, the obsidian's medicinal properties.
Right.
It seems like it's going to be important, but I'll be damned if I know how.
Yeah.
Like, I mean, it would it seem silly, like, if that gives you some kind of resistance to fire to, like, come up with some kind of inoculation you could give to all the Unsullied so they're fireproof? So they can more effectively fight alongside the dragons? Is it something
Maybe.
The Night's King can use
but
to
like,
make the whites fireproof?
But, like, how important is that, you know? Like, if you've got dragons overhead blowing fire, do you really need the Unsullied in there?
Right. Yeah.
Is that going to be more effective at all?
Well, I mean, they probably have to be. They probably have to be supported by foot troops or.
Yeah, I don't know. I don't see the importance of it, but it's clearly still there.
All right. Virgil in California. After Arya's scene, I'm beginning to detect a pattern. She killed the entire line of Freys between season 6, episode 10, and last night's episode. Sansa killed Ramsay Bolton with the hounds, ending the line of House Bolton. Brienne avenges her king by killing Stannis, ending the line of House Baratheon, except for maybe Gendry, who is never recognized as legitimate. The Sand Snakes ended House Martell in last season's opener. While Cersei didn't kill all the Tyrells, she killed all the legitimate heirs, and Lady Olenna is too old to have another child. So far, 5 houses all ended by women, and Dany has just landed on Westeros. Yeah, that's an interesting little girl power note that the women have essentially destroyed the world of the men here.
Yeah.
Well on their way.
I wonder if that has any tie-in with the, you know, destroying the wheel. Taking out these dynasties.
On a related note, Diana L., I really love the conversation between Sansa and Jon Snow about their father and Cersei. Sansa says her father protected her from how dirty the world really is. Her father didn't prepare her for the world as he prepared his sons. Directly after that, Sansa describes Cersei in a negative but admirable light. Although Cersei was horrible to Sansa, she did teach her things her father never did, but prepared her for the world. She prepared her in the worst possible way, but still prepared her. Mm-hmm. Sansa started out weak and lacking confidence, and now she's strong enough to question Jon in front of his men and describe to Jon the importance of a ruler not having blind followers. A powerful message of strength and growth for Sansa, and therefore for women in general. I hope Sansa doesn't become as heartless as Cersei, but it didn't seem as if Sophie Turner acted those lines out of malice or bitterness as Cersei would have, although time will tell. Yeah, I'm still up in the air about everything you said is true. I'm just up in the air about the last part about how is it going to work out, you know? Like Sansa says,
yeah, it's a dangerous thing.
Yes.
I think that being taught in that way, I think, can have effects on people that maybe they even don't understand themselves.
It's like throwing a kid into the deep end of the pool to teach them to swim. They might learn to swim, but they might not come away with a crippling fear of water.
Yeah.
Or
they might realize what a great tool for torture water is and start waterboarding people. Like,
right.
You just don't know how they're going to use it, how it's going to affect them. So I'm up in the air where Sansa's going to land on this.
Mm-hmm.
And it's scary, honestly, because I do like her as a character. I think all the things you said about her growing and being much stronger and more confident are true. I just hope she doesn't go overboard with it.
Adam had a question about Bran's green seeing, the fact that he was able to apparently do some green seeing or warging without being touching a weirwood tree.
Okay.
I mean, that's a true statement. We do know that canonically the three-eyed raven says that, you know, you start with the trees because they're the easiest things, and then eventually it's almost like that's a crutch that you don't need. So I guess my question is, are we supposed to see that this is Bran's developing as a greenseer? Is he more powerful now?
Could be, but I mean, he kind of started that way, didn't he? I mean, warging into wolves.
But he warged into a wolf that he had a very personal relationship with.
Okay.
And then he warged into Hodor, who was a simpleton that he also had a close personal relationship with. And then he could green see through the trees, and now he's doing. So I don't know. And it seems
now
like
he's
was
like seeing historical events and stuff.
Yeah,
tree. Yeah. I'm cool with saying he's growing as a greenseer.
We're nearing the end here. Rebecca S., I had this nagging thought after last night's episode. Arya goes on a murder spree wearing Walder's Frey face. He tells his family supporters they should have made sure to kill every last Stark because a lone wolf will kill them all. Meanwhile, she kills everyone except Walder's wife and servants. Is this foreshadowing, kindness, stupidity on her part? Shouldn't the little wolf be practicing what she preaches? They're not wolves.
Yeah, those aren't wolves. Those are sheep.
And you guys think Arya started off before she went through this process sticking dudes in Flea Bottom with Needle.
Mm-hmm.
No problem. And she's been tutored by the First Sword of Braavos. She's been tutored by a faceless man. She's been tutored by the Hound. Like, unless Lord Walder's seventh teenage wife can have that same experience, then I'm not really afraid for the Starks.
No, I'm more afraid for the leftover phrase, like all the wives and daughters.
Mm.
What the hell are they going to do now?
Yeah.
I guess they got to continue running the twins.
Well, that's another good point. Like, what happens to – well, in fact, let's not steal Michael Kay's thunder. What's the significance of the Frey's family going down entirely to the world at large? I think a subtle point of the Ed Sheeran scene was to show that there is turmoil in that region. There's now a vacuum of power, and whoever seizes the bridge may change the dynamics of the wars to come. Clearly, this is intended for storytelling, but I can't figure out why. I don't know. They can't tell
maybe
white
it's a reverse
from red wine. Are we sure that this is intended in the storytelling?
We need the reverse Craster's Keep at the twins. Where all the wives now start all the men as their
concubines
and
breeders,
sons, and
yeah, sperm
just get
dispensers.
Real gross up in the twins.
But it's like it's lady dominated,
yeah,
instead of male dominated.
It's the inverse caster, Craster.
All right, I could get down with that. But he's right. Like the twins, they've established them as a very decisive choke point. If you have a large army. It's far more efficient to move north and south if you've got the ability to go through the twins. So now that the fact that they're unoccupied, what is that going to do vis-a-vis keeping the White Walkers north? What's that going to do as far as keeping Cersei south? Interesting questions. I don't have the answer to.
Yeah, and
but you're perceptive to pick those up.
Like, who's going to find out that information first and be able to move, right?
Right.
Because I think if Jon finds that information, that the twins are all but abandoned.
He can go secure him.
He could go secure them, but will he?
Maybe.
You know?
I mean,
or does he think the greater threat is from the north and so they can have the south?
And maybe, Pace, one of our emailers previously, the next episode we'll see Arya continue into the Riverlands and free her uncle, and she'll put him in charge of that. I don't know.
Yeah.
But that is a... And then the other thing is, like, there was only 12 episodes to go. Maybe there's nothing to be made of this choke point. So,
yeah.
Because you got flying dragons and a large army already north. Maybe you don't need it. Stephanie B., watching Season 7, Episode 1 on Sunday tonight, I started seeing some pretty significant differences between Dany and Jon. This is particularly evident during the scene where we see Sansa contradicting Jon's decision regarding the Karstarks and Umbers. I can't help but feel even more strongly about the fact that Jon Snow was born to be a leader, while Dany was not. Under ordinary circumstances, Dany wouldn't be anywhere near the Iron Throne's line of succession if the Mad King had not been defeated, Rhaegar not killed, and Dany's crazy molten-headed brother not killed by Drogo. The fact is, Dany has been pursuing something she never really had a claim to. In the same way that Jon has his King of the North status thrown upon him. The difference lies in the stark differences in their ability to make decisions. I see your pun. I don't care if you said no pun intended. You can't throw a Stark in there and not intend a pun. Dany was repeatedly made poor choices, caused harm, death, and heartache to people she's determined to free and seems to feel the need to prove herself. It's as if she thinks that brash decisions are okay because who can stand against a woman with dragons? Jon, on the other hand, has been the level-headed and true child of Winterfell. Do we have any doubt that Dany would have taken the lands from the Umbers and the Karstarks? What do you think, Jim? Does Dany go fire and blood here? Is she merciful? And we've seen her do both.
We have, and she seems to be very flip-floppy, and she's not a very experienced leader. She's getting more experienced.
That's the big
same
thing.
The same is true of Jon. I think there are a lot of parallels between the two,
right.
Other than, you know, mad queen status potential.
Right.
But I think they're both still learning, and they're both prone to making mistakes. I don't know how they're going to shake out,
right?
But it's going to be interesting, I think.
I mean, you know, you never can forget that Dany's story was that
she was essentially her brother's sex slave up until the moment that she rode Drogo cowboy style, cowgirl style.
Right, turned into his sex slave. Like,
but then she turned the tables on, but those were the first, that was her first act of agency. Mm-hmm. And, you know, a lot of people that, you know, the classic response to people being bored with Dany in Marine is, well, this is her training, in the same way that John going to the wall and learning the difference between, you know, his, because he's all woe is me, but he had to learn, like, he had a relative life of privilege. There's like many lessons that he had to learn, but he had, like, you know, a chain of command that's, you know, he had Corrin Halfhand and he had the old bear, Jorah Mormont, and he had advisors and friends and fucking Aemon Targaryen, like all these old steady hands that teach him things about leadership and command that were instrumental when he finally had to take over. And also he had Ned.
Yeah.
Like, you know, yeah, he was a bastard, but Ned still thought it serious enough to teach him how to use arms and armor. And whereas Dany had none of those advantages. So I tend to cut Dany more slack when it comes to this stuff. And also, I do think there is a difference in their temperament that, you know, John was never as hot-blooded and Targaryen-ish, I guess, as his aunt.
And John seems – so I guess the point that I agree with here is that John seems Dany seems very eager to take on this leadership role and wants to be the leader, right, wants to come conquer. John almost seems the opposite. John seems like he wants to do the thing that's right, and nobody else is fucking doing it, so he's got to. He's almost a reluctant leader.
Yeah, but do you think – I'm trying to think. I guess Dany started flexing pretty early on in her Khaleesi role.
The first time she strolls out of the fire, it's
but even then,
over.
Before then, she was testing, like, you know, like getting off her horse and walking in the weeds until, like, she was doing things to kind of test how much power she had. So maybe, she was off. But then again, you know, John was chasing as much honor and glory as he thought befitted his station. I mean, that's the whole reason he went to the wall.
They've responded to their success differently, I guess. John seems to want to keep the notion of himself as a leader at arm's length here, whereas Dany very much leans into it.
Right. It would be interesting to see their roles reversed. I mean, you'd have to envision a gender bender world where the women were welcome at the wall, but like, give John, you know, the power of a Dothraki horde and three dragons, and then send him on that journey versus Dany being at the wall and having that slow, you know, methodical teaching of leadership and martial skills and how to motivate people. It'd be interesting. I mean, it's a complete moot point because even if you did reverse them, it would never happen because Dany, again, is not a man.
Right.
And this is some kind of bullshit patriarch or nightmare that they're living in. there you go. That is all of the feedback.
Okay.
So send any non-fucking spoiler predictions to gameofthrones@baldmove.com, we will consider them. And if you didn't get your email read and it had anything to do with spoilers, know that there is a whole other podcast coming out at the end of this week, Friday afternoon, called the Spoiler Edition, where we talk about because even though that the shows have eclipsed the books and have gone past them, there's still some nuggets. There's still some prophecies and some evidence in the books that we can kind of use to guess and predict things in the show. And of course, it's always also fun to get into the backstory of the world and some of the world building that's much more in the books and the supporting materials. And that's what we're all about in the Spoiler Edition. So join us back Friday. It's still not too late to get your emails in for that. GameofThrones@baldmove.com.
All right. Well, I guess we will see you guys on Friday.
Yeah, we'll see you then. Until then, I'm Aaron.
And I'm Jim.
Bye-bye. But episode 12 kind of explains the whole Black Lodge, White Lodge, Spirit Quest stuff in very plain language, and it stars a cross-dressing David Duchovny.
All right.
Who I heard that he was a guest star, and I'm like, oh, well, I want to see David Duchovny. When he walked in, like, David Duchovny from the mid-nose up is a beautiful woman.
From the mid-nose up.
It all goes it's apart when you get to the nose and the very mat. But like I was like, because when he first walked in, I'm like, well, who the hell? And I'm like, oh shit, this is David Duchovny.
He have like a scarf over half his face? Or
no,
something?
He just walked in. He had shaved his legs. Looks like his arms. He's wearing a wig and very well done makeup and flattering dress.
I'm confused as to where the division of the face came in. Is that just something you mentally did?
Because I'm like, because I was getting mixed, so half the time I was getting like, this is attractive vibe, and then half the time I was like, well, this is amazing.
This
know.
Is David Duchovny.
So I actually took my hand out and I was doing this, and I'm like, I was like, Cecily, like cover everything from the mid nose up. Like he is a drop dead gorgeous late 80s woman, is he not?
It's the Michelle Pfeiffer of half faces.
Yeah. Yeah. He's like got this like young Demi Moore kind of thing going on. And his eyes are very pretty.
Wow. Okay.
And he's got he's also
what about his hands? I hear his hands are pretty good.
I don't know. I did notice he had fairly nice legs.